cash flows, and that is normally something that that they indicated to us was part of those types of approvals. And so we've been providing that data to them. It's not a burden at all. We've been doing that since June of 2016. And so then that, when we were placed on HCM for the few months that we were, again, that had to do with the goodwill impairment charge that hit us in 2015. Again, and that was part of our response to Ed, that was a non-cash technical accounting matter, and they understood, which they never confirmed to us, but we certainly believe is a key consideration for the fact that they waited almost a full year before they imposed that restriction on us, and it was only imposed for a short few months before they took that off. Whereas normal course of action, they could have imposed that within receipt of our 2015 financials.
The replacement rates are obviously strong. Default rates are only average.
Well, I guess the question is, do we have precedent, given that the statute or the rules state that 2 years of losses require a sharing bond?
It's not required.
It is an indicator of an issue. It's one of our
inconsistent in applying.
That rule just went into effect. This is this is the first cycle where I really zeroed in on 2 years.
Besides the rule, has the board consistently been using that as a criteria?
Before that? I don't know if that did say one or the other.
The idea of the bond is to make sure that we're protecting the consumers, but we obviously also have to be, fair and equitable between the schools.
That's my only concern.
I would just caution against, stating history of the existence of a school, because I think we've seen a couple of schools crash in very recent memory that we're still dealing with.
But Lexington, at least, they did a very smooth, proper teach out. So Lampson did not, other than emotionally, the school had been around for so long it was gone. But for our consumers, we were okay. So for discussion, each of you, your idea of whether we should or should not ask for the surety bond?
What's the calculation?
It's at the top of the page.
5.9.
$6 million.
Oh. I know, that's very large.
We just put that to Arizona, though.
What's that?
The other school? That would not be enough.
1.3. I would say that having the surety bond is the prudent course is it's consistent with other actions that we've taken.
I agree.
I think the flexibility would be higher now than the surety bond. Adjust that. I think we're confident the surety bond makes the most sense given the past 2 years and consistent application of our board to the level school.
Then the question would be what would your rationale be to reduce it by how much and for what reason? Just
solid compiling score.
That would be valid.
What did you say?
Solid composite score.
A solid composite score.
The current ratio
is strong also. And so for the recent investment in the institution, speaks to the financial some of the risk.
And also not having issues with accrediting and also having taken off HCM1, I think are positive in their favor as well. So then it comes up to how do we come up with a proposal of what a fair and equitable number would be. I'm not the numbers person.
Well, their program, they're not anywhere close to 90-10 either because of all the corporate support that they have. They're way, way below. They're closer to 70-75% as their use of federal funds, which may argue.
Which goes against the opposite way.
But that was a big part of that discussion.
My only thing is we had a conversation with another school and we ended up talking ourselves out of it.
But the thing with that other school though, and the issues we're saying we're taking into account here, is that they are not on a slippery slope of their trouble with accrediting, having any sanctions taken against them. So they actually have had sanctions. Not actually sanctions, you know, but a slap, whatever. Say they've had them removed and they've had influx of cash in a non-weird way like the last one is, right? So I think that their stability is a different picture than the stability of those other schools. And not that any school couldn't tank tomorrow and catch a surprise, because we certainly have been surprised. But do I have that level of trouble sleeping tonight worried about, you know, all of these thousands of students at UTIMI? No. Am I more worried about the other schools or the things going on? And I don't think they have any big barrier to get over where the others, in my opinion, do. Unless you have barriers you'd like to tell us about that we don't know.
We're not aware of any barriers.
You're not aware? You just don't want to tell us because you have another meeting coming. You have to do it.
No, we're not aware of any.
All right, just check out.
I agree. It's a question of judgment and risk. I mean, we're trying to assess the risk that we get hit, you know, with a huge charge against our
Well, in one case, the institution is, you know, had some accreditation issues, and another, the institution is heavy cash with the students putting more bill than the head of four. So,
well, in this case, I don't think it's that the students are paying the bill. It seems like it's potentially from other sources.
The two sources that drive down our 90-10 calculation, we do have a heavier than average influx of military VA funded students. And so that counts. That doesn't count on your 90 side, based on the 90-10 calculation.
Yeah. At this time. That, the beds in a closure are hurt the worst. Because at this point, their eligibility benefits are just gone.
And they don't get the money, I would assume.
No.
The government
paid
it.
There's no way to transfer them to another. There's no way to reset their VA benefits. There's a huge gap.
And the other piece that you mentioned is basically the corporate funding. We have a lot of employer partners.
The board is contemplating adjusting the bond in this case, based on specific criteria that differentiates this case from previous cases. And I'm just trying to make a list of criteria.
Right here.
Accreditation.
Strong composite score. Accreditation.
Strong current ratio.
Do you guys look at the default? Does default weigh for you at all? Default rate? Is that a significant thing to you? Or no?
If they were a lot higher, they're not as great. They're kind of in the average proprietary school, so nothing to brag about, but also nothing to. I don't think it goes either way in favor or against them, in my opinion.
And to one point on that, on the default rates, particularly with the Avondale school group, we just recently got that below 15.5, which is a more restrictive standard in California for Cal Grant eligibility. So we've just now been provided Cal Grant eligibility for our California schools, the two in Southern California again. And the Northern California school is part of the MMI campus group. And again, we're you know, our preliminary indications are we're going to be very, very close to getting Cal Grant back there. Okay. So we're hopeful that the next cohort release will indicate that. But we've been making really good strides partnering with Loan Science to make sure we get those default rates down. Yeah.
I'd like to make a motion, Madam Chair. And prior to my motion, I'll explain some of my rationale. In light of the mitigating circumstances that we've discussed, I think we should reduce the bond. And so, and those mitigating factors include all the ones that we just mentioned. It has to do also, I would add the graduate placement rate is strong too. That's good in terms of the outcome. So given all those circumstances, I would make a motion that we approve the license renewal for both UTI and MMI with the condition that we impose half of the bond calculation, which would be $3 million instead of $6
million. Second.
Okay. Motion and second. Any further discussion?
There was in the staff recommendation that electronic copies of student records are provided on.
I'll add that to my motion. Obviously, we're going to need that.
Can I ask a clarification? When you say student records, is that more of a listing of the students and the
transcript ledger cards are primary.
And they provide an
enrollment agreement.
It's our big three.
Yeah. I'm assuming you have all your student records electronically. Given the local corporation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I get a second to my motion? Yes, second.
So that motion is including the $3 million bond and complying with the monthly record requirements?
Yes.
So motion second. Do we have any further comments? Do you accept those stipulations?
Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? You did have the authority to accept that, right?
I do.
Okay. Just checking.
Chief Financial.
I do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Provisional degree granting license renewal for Cummings Graduate Institute of Behavioral Studies, and Reed is.
No, me.
Nothing.
Ms. Deco, will you give us a comment?
Madam Chair, members of the board, Cummings is seeking renewal of the 27 provisional degree granting license. Because it is provisional, it will automatically be referred to you every year until full accreditation is granted. But as well as Cummings is on quarterly reporting. The Finance Committee reviewed the financial statements at the March meeting, and the Finance Committee recommends that the board determines to approve the provisional that the $100,000 surety bond be maintained and to continue quarterly reporting. And your board member lead is...
Me, yeah.
Thank you. Jake.
Okay. Would you please state your name for the record and your position?
Yes. I'm Dr. Kara English. I'm the CEO of Cummings Graduate Institute, Director of its UCH program.
I'm Brett Subtee. I'm the Director of Finance.
Okay. Would you care to make an opening statement on just the overview of how the institution is doing?
Sure.
I'm sorry?
Can you just see if there's anyone on the phone, so someone else needs to hear.
Is Dr. Cummings on the line?
She is not.
No?
CGI is still a brand new school, relatively speaking, and we are working on increasing public awareness of our institution and our Doctor of Behavioral Health programs. Mm-hmm. So we've recently been directing several new marketing efforts and really focusing on building brand awareness as well as reaching our target audience in a more effective and efficient way. We're also throwing all of our efforts at working on our SER. So we're planning to submit sometime this summer and just returned from our third we attended our third conference for the accreditation body that we're planning to apply to this summer, and are on track for submitting on time. We also are working very hard at financial fitness and are working on improving our policies and practices around maintaining all of our financial standards, and also you know, just working within a conservative budget that's been approved by our board. Lack of accreditation is our toughest hurdle to enrollment. And while we have a great deal of interest coming in because of our new marketing efforts, we continue to get that first question, are you accredited, each and every day. We still have quite a good deal of interest, and we're looking at 6 new applications for the fall, beginning in the fall. And our new admissions and student engagement advisor is working with those students to help them get into the door. And so we are looking forward to working with them. We also are working on some strategic workforce development partnerships that may bear fruit sometime within the next couple of years, during or after we achieve accreditation.
Okay, thank you. So thank you for the recap. It's very similar to what you expressed with the Finance Committee as far as your new admissions coordinator, new marketing team, progress on DEAC, which was, you answered that question. Thank you. I was wondering how your progress is going. You're mm-hmm. on track with everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we're doing very well.
And then you did say at our finance committee that about the Cummings Foundation will commit to funding and continue. So, a couple more questions. So, talk to us a little bit more about your recruiting efforts. You have possibly 7 interested parties.
6 at this time, 6. Yes. And we continue to receive a number of applicants who state that they've done a lot of research and are very informed about our program compared to the couple of other programs like ours in the field, and have chosen us for very specific reasons. They like that we're small, they don't mind that we're not accredited, and they appreciate the specific delivery model or the clinical model, as well as the entrepreneurship aim, as well as the very, you know, intense guidance and advice that we provide our students with the culminating project. We allow students to really target efforts from an entrepreneurship model rather than, you know, forcing them to start their own business or asking them to do a clinical research study. So we really tailor it to their specific career interests. And we have the, you know, small and very personable staff and faculty to be able to really deliver on that promise. So those are reasons why several of the students who've entered our school within the past year, and also those who are looking to enter in the fall, are really excited about coming on board with us. So our targeted marketing effort is really, you know, again, at brand awareness and looking at really improving the awareness of who we are and that we offer this degree into the behavioral health field as well as the medical field.
Good. So your self-evaluation is due in August of 2007?
We become eligible on June 1st. And so based on our current staff and our current processes, we also have a consultant or two that we're working with to ensure that we won't be submitting an application before we're ready. That would, you know, be bad for us and delay our progress ultimately. So we anticipate submitting that application in August.
Okay. Now, do they? I'm not very familiar with DEAC, but at what point do you have the designation of like serious candidate mm-hmm. status, where then your students in the program enrolled at that time will uh-huh. have accreditation recognition?
So we just attended a conference for DEAC in San Antonio and met with the executive director, and we discussed this with her. And by her recommendation, if we submit an application this summer, the soonest that we could get onto the commission meeting agenda would probably be next summer. So we'd look at about 12 months in between, and so we'd be looking at a spring designation as a candidate. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 18 months, by a conservative estimate, is what we were told.
Okay. All right. I just have a couple more questions. Here. Looking at your 5-day cancellation period. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a 3-day cancellation period in Arizona, and they have to be fully refunded.
Not accredited.
They can choose to do 5.
They can choose. Okay, that was my...
DEAC's is 5.
Okay.
So...
We made some changes to our current catalog based on our progress towards our SER and, you know, to be in alignment with DEAC.
Okay, very good. That answers my question. You do have some typos.
Okay.
Under, like, your refund policy.
Okay.
It says tuition fees and non-refundable application fees.
Okay, good to know.
Double secret.
Non-refundable, double secret.
But that is a common mistake in a lot of your in the refund policy explanations or throughout your catalog and your enrollment agreement, so I just want to let you know.
Thank you for letting us know. We'll take it.
And then up there, too, denied admission refunds, non-refundable, non-refundable.
That is very interesting. I wonder how that happened. We'll figure it out, though. Thank you.
And this is one of the things, the old-fashioned deal of that when you're relying on things just popping out through Word, we get so many catalogs that have so many, sometimes comically incorrect information, that I would suggest that you have somebody read it, perhaps
okay.
somebody who has not worked on it, so they may not be looking for whether the rules are correct or not, but they're literally reading it to see if it makes any sense whatsoever.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a great recommendation. Our institute librarian is a former grammar teacher, and she reviews everything, but, you know, those kinds of things still happen. So we'll continue to look at that, and thank you for letting us know so we can make that correction.
The student grievance process, when it was denied, then the student has up to 3 months to submit. That seems like a long time.
I never cut, too.
That's huge.
I started doing an investigation that long.
Right. I mean, if they wait to 90 days, that's a very long time to say, okay, what exactly happened here? Maybe the grades have already been submitted.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a new semester, possibly.
Right.
Can you talk to about what the reasoning was on that?
Sure. Initially, we were really just trying to be as fair as possible to our students. That's really been our goal from the outset. And we noticed that we had at the previous institutions that we had been affiliated with, there were students who were afraid to come forth. Right off the bat because of either a fear that their grades or GPA would be in some way harmed by that. And so our hope was that, you know, by giving them some extra time, they could consult with, you know, colleagues or other faculty members who might be able to support them and encourage them to bring a grievance if they felt like that needed to happen. So it was trying to be fair, but if you feel like it's too long, we can certainly look at
it is kind of a catch-22. I hear what you're trying to do, but also if you prolong it too long, and then they may suffer from the other side saying,
mm-hmm.
well, I'm not getting this resolved quickly enough.
Okay.
Well, I think that it's nice your reasoning for doing
mm-hmm.
it, and you know, we have a longer period of how long they have it to bring it to us, but her comment about that, are you going to be able to investigate it and, you know,
mm-hmm.
staff leave or whatever,
mm-hmm.
so you just want to have a balance there, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't know, just make sure that people know that if they're coming forth with a grievance, they have to come with their own information as well. So if it's something very vague, they may lose the grievance because they simply don't have enough information to back it up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes people do wait till their deadline to do it. So
right.
if you want to look at the wording maybe a little bit to say something like students are encouraged to bring it as promptly as possible, but may go up to 3 months, you know, something so that they understand that the expectation is they do it sooner. But you'll accept it up to 3 months. That might meet both goals.
Okay.
What would be the standard of grievance that you see in other institutions?
There isn't really one, is there?
It's all over the board.
Never more than 2 weeks, 14 days. That's what I've seen.
I'm familiar with 5.
With what?
5 weeks.
You might want to also.
It's all over the board.
Yeah,
it's
like,
in this
industry,
benchmark at this point.
It's, you can borrow ideas from whoever you want. So you may want to look at schools that either you respect or are similar, and then look at that to see peers are doing.
I think it also depends on your student cycle, you know, because,
right.
for example, Christmas break can be 3 weeks or whatever. It's those kinds of things that come into play.
And I don't think you want it to be too far away, because what happens is it can go back and change a whole bunch of things, especially if you file financial aid, going back and re-looking at SAP and all sorts of other things. So
okay.
That's one of the...
Thank you.
Those are all the questions I had.
He's going to have some good questions, but I'll let him go first. I just have one question. Do you plan to ultimately apply for Title IV as well? Is that part of your goal?
It is part of our goal. We try to keep tuition as affordable as possible, because we really hope that they'll go out and do entrepreneurial things, new things within the healthcare industry, either as a current employee or start their own businesses and be able to do that. And their ability to do that really will rest on their low debt ratio as a graduate. So we want to make sure that we are able to continue to keep that tuition low. But yes, we would. We understand, coming from the behavioral health field myself, when I entered the Doctor of Behavioral Health program, it wouldn't have been possible for me to enter the program without Title IV funds and, myself. I tried to, keep that debt ratio very, very low, but we also want students who would not otherwise be able to enter the program to have that same opportunity. So,
then this is a suggestion, is that as you're going forth and going with DAC, the way that the rules go is the state doesn't have quite as many rules, and then DAC has a bunch of rules, and then Title IV has a bunch of rules. And some of the Title IV rules don't apply until you actually get Title IV. But some of them you can actually put into place.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, you're not going to have to change as many things again. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to be writing your catalog and your policies and procedures, and then you only have to, add in how it impacts Title IV as opposed to revising the entire policy. Mm-hmm. And so administratively, it might make it easier for you. And as simple as a leave of absence, almost every school we have to come in that's going for Title IV has a leave of absence policy that does not comply with Title IV. They have a satisfactory academic progress policy that does not comply with Title IV. They have confusion of their calendar, and the Department of Ed wants to know if you are a standard term, a non-standard term, clock hour, are you quarter credit, semester credit, is your term a quarter, a semester, or whatever. And we have schools coming in, want to go to the Department of Ed, and we're like, wow, don't submit this catalog because you're not going to get approved. So if you just take the time now, and like I said, not every single Title IV rule you have to put in there, but some of those basic ones, it would still be you to do it now, and it'll save you so much grief later.
Yeah. Thank you.
And us. We'll see next
week, too. So a couple of questions. Brett, are you still on the board of directors?
Yes, sir.
And your position at the institute is?
For the Cummings Graduate Institute is the financial director.
It's an interim position. We formerly had a finance director who was terminated recently, and so Mr. Sabatini has been helping advise us from the get-go as representative of the board. And so at this time, his position with us is in advisory capacity until we're able to hire someone new.
It's problematic,
right?
For the board to discharge its fiduciary responsibility of the person reporting financial to the board, and so I don't think that it's enough of an alarm for us, but from the accreditation standpoint, we saw one of the first schools here that there were one of the questions is there sufficient autonomy?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
We're absolutely working
so
towards
you
that.
May consider like taking a leave of absence until you fill that position, just so that you don't get adversely affected.
Okay.
Accreditation process. Could you? And I think I asked this during the finance audit committee. Could you distinguish between there's a charitable contribution of $724,000 in the income statement, and then in addition to that, there's a note payable.
Correct.
Could you distinguish between the two and share what the share contribution is?
Difference. So when we originally started the institute, we were receiving funds from the Cummings family personally to help to fund the operations and get everything moving until we got to a 501c3 status. At which that point happened, we were then able to start to receive funds from their donor-advised fund to continue operations. And they committed at that point in time the $964,000 annually from the donor-advised fund to the Institute. So what you see from the note standpoint is the original note that Cummings personally put in that they were looking to receive back at profitability of the school.
So there's no specific date?
No specific date at this time.
Okay. And then the $724,283?
The difference between that was we didn't get funding until Q2. So you have a gap there.
That represents three
Correct.
Quarters of the $960,000.
Correct.
And the family donor advised fund is
they've made that on an ongoing basis, long term, for sure through accreditation is what we've been told in the last board meeting, and then reassess at that point in time.
So for about how many years do you
I'm from that standpoint, we were estimating about 24 months at this point in time.
From now?
Yeah, from now.
I think from a, you're the finance director, so.
Yeah, again.
And who's the development person?
Development person from which standpoint?
Fundraising.
Fundraising?
Yeah.
That would be me.
That would be her. Yeah.
You, may want to say to you. if they, in fact, are committed to making a multi-year commitment to the Institute, that having that as several people, the Arizona Christian School is mm-hmm. referring to
mm-hmm.
a pledge made today mm-hmm. will get present value according to GAAP.
Yeah.
It will have a much better effect on your books so that, from accreditation standpoint, you're not going to go into your accreditation process with a loss on your income statement because, let's say, just for argument's sake, let's say you had 3 years mm-hmm. of the $960,000, right?
Yeah.
And so that's, a little bit under $1 million a year.
Yeah.
And so roughly 70% of that you would recognize right off the bat, and then as it gets paid off, it would go from a restricted to an unrestricted gift. So basically, that $2 point something million gift offsets all of these losses, so that you're not showing it on a regular basis.
I think it's a good.
You guys have to.
It's a great suggestion.
It seems like like a super generous, family, and so why not? Have it work as much to your advantage, because that way it also shows that that their gift is sufficient to carry the Institute
yep.
through the accrediting period, which I think the accrediting body would say
that. Yep. Thank you for that recommendation.
That's all.
I have some.
Oh, can I say one more thing? We have you listed on the report as a for-profit corporation. As I understand
right.
it,
no,
you are 501c3.
Yeah. Yes.
I didn't change the report.
Okay. See that too. Okay.
I was reading through the history, and I'm just trying to make sure that I understand kind of your format. So your license was granted on April 2nd of 2015, correct? 2014.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So in December of 2015, the notes indicate that you had 4 students graduate.
Correct. We had many students those initial students transferred from a previous institution where they had almost all of their coursework completed. and were waiting for us to open our school so that they could complete their degree. So they transferred over and they completed their degree and defended their culminating projects with us and defended that.
Okay, so you made an exception to your transfer policy.
Okay. We did. Actually, if you go back to our original application, our transfer policy stated that students could transfer up to half of their credits, but that we would make, well, I guess, yes, you're right. They could appeal the policy based on the fact that we were only one of two programs nationwide or internationally that offered the Doctor of Behavioral Health program. So the idea was that we needed to offer students an opportunity to transfer to the one other program if they didn't have another choice elsewhere.
Okay.
And those were the only four students. We actually changed our policy to be in alignment with DEAC as we move forward for accreditation purposes. So our credit transfer max is now 9.
Okay, so one place in here, I noticed it said no. It said we do not accept transfer credit. It was either one was in the enrollment agreement and one was in the catalog, and they were not the same. It says here on your student acknowledgement, the Cummings Graduate Institute does not accept transfer credit for previous education. Unless you're talking about something else.
Is that the enrollment agreement?
That's the student acknowledgement form.
Could I take a look at that, please?
Yeah.
And then in here, I noticed that it was in the catalog. It was.
Yeah, we have a whole section in our catalog on transfer students. Thank you.
And the 9 was more typical of what I'm familiar with doctoral programs.
I don't think that was what we intended on the acknowledgments. What we would have intended on the acknowledgments here would have been for work experience. So what we need to take out, it looks like, is the previous education, and then leave in training and work experience for club. So we'll take care of that. Thank you for.
One of the other things I had a question about was, so I just tried to look up some other behavioral health doctoral programs, and I've noticed some of them have internships, and you don't have that.
That's because of state authorization barriers. So when we initially enrolled our students, many of those who transferred, we had to look at, you know, just the landscape of higher education as distance learning were fully online. And there were many states that we had students who either wanted to come in at that time or that we wanted to enroll for, and their state policies were such that we couldn't have a practicum. It was a physical presence trigger.
Right.
So part of the way that we decided to move forward until we're accredited and we could seek that, you know, broader state authorization was to remove the practicum requirement. A lot of that was based on the fact that our students who were coming in didn't need a practicum. They were already working in the field. They were already employed by either integrated care facilities or hospitalist organizations where they could implement from that entrepreneurship model an applied project. So there was really no need, and frankly, there were a lot of complaints and concerns about the practicum program in the previous program. So it actually solved a lot of problems for both us and the students.
And the accreditation you're seeking is actually the distance education one, is it not? So it's
correct.
Not behavioral health specific, so they're not going to expect to see that in your program. Okay. The other thing I noticed, and just it was just a thought for you as a scalability, I noticed that you guys, you have like a requirement of, 17 elective credits, correct? But in your program requirements, you guys give a lot more. And my only thing to you is that you might want to scale that down until
right.
you come to a student count that makes sense to offer more.
Part of the reason that we try to be very flexible with electives is because we want students to really, again, pursue their own career trajectory with electives. So for students who are already working with the geriatric population, to force them to take children and adolescents or, you know, some of the other courses that are more specific to other populations seems a little unfair. We also offer students the ability to work one-on-one with a faculty member or several faculty members to complete independent study kinds of research and applied projects so that if they're hoping to work in oncology that they can go that direction, because we don't offer that course. But it gives them credit for, you know, pursuing that additional research, and it even gives them the opportunity to publish in that area because there's such a paucity of research in that any of those areas when it comes to integrated care right now. So our hope is that, you know, by giving them that flexibility again, it'll really help them in the end.
Yeah, and I totally understand that. I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You're just balancing, the, you know what I mean? Because this is almost double. You're, I mean, you have 17 required, and you have like 33 credit options. And
right.
So I'm just
one of the things as we're moving forward too is we're looking at, you know, shifting a little bit in terms of what courses are core. Mm-hmm. And again, it's, you know, we are in a field that is a niche within a niche. And we're really trying to be very much in alignment with the current healthcare marketplace and what's being asked of our graduates. And so from our perspective, we're looking at, you know, creating an advisory board that is very robust, both for the institution as well as our program, so that we can really continuously improve the program. Part of it, though, is that, you know, anytime you make a change over that 25% mark, it triggers a new application. And so, you know, we want to make sure we're not making too many changes or too big of changes. It hurts the students, and it's balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And just tag on that real quick. Sometimes when schools are smaller and they're trying to cover so many things at once, they stretch themselves thin,
mm-hmm.
and they end up unintentionally breaking a rule,
mm-hmm.
like the offer program. Course rather, and there's really no one available. The student really wants it, so then they tried like jerry rig it to offer the student that course, but really now they're really doing more like as a correspondent or something instead of just said.
Okay.
So make sure that if someone is picking a course, that you do have the resources to make sure you're properly offering it,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to go on a slippery slope and then have questions to the new degree.
Okay. Thank you.
Some of my other questions were trying to understand the format of how students go to school. So from what I understood from materials, they take two courses each term, which is 12-week term, two 12-week terms, and a summer term of 7 weeks.
That is one option. We don't require students to take more than one course per semester. And so there are some students who will take one course per semester just because of affordability.
Mm-hmm.
They have a 5-year max. And so we want them to graduate within 5 years. But at the end of the day, if they take one course per semester or two or three, some are taking three per semester right now, we just advise them and you know, say you will not be able to work full-time if you're taking three 12-week, three-credit courses right now in your semester.
I was mathematically trying to get to where you said that they couldn't complete the program in less than 2 years. I was trying to figure out
the world could... We just don't believe that it's possible for them to do that.
Right, but it said here that they had to at least be in the program for 2 years, and I thought that
right, that's a minimum. Yeah, there are other programs that say you can complete the program in 18 months, and we just don't believe that that's advisable.
I wouldn't even know how they would do that. I didn't know if you had, like, overload, like what is the maximum that a student could take every term?
What we tell students is that we don't advise them to take more than 3 credits per term, and we do have a max that's listed in our catalog. I haven't memorized it, so it's in there somewhere, but what we advise them to do is not take more than 3 credits per semester, because most of them are working full-time, and it's they go insane,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Okay.
If I could ask, just sticking with the what type of program you have,
mm-hmm.
Your catalog was actually one that I was thinking of when I said, school get up to be a Department of Ed and you're not meeting it. It was so confusing, and it's interesting. Is she's kind of bringing up some points different than the ones that I bring up, because we're coming sort of like from different places in our background. So first of all, a semester, by definition for the department, is on average 15 a week. Mm-hmm. Can't be less than 14, but two combined have to be at least 30 without all sorts of special permission that you're not going to get. My first caution is, while they don't regulatorily say you cannot use the word semester, trust me, if you use that word semester and you're not really meeting what a semester is, you're going to have nothing but heartache and despair for everyone who works for you, on your audit, everything. So don't use that word unless you mean it. And if you mean it, then it needs to be average 15 weeks. And that has to be 15 instructional weeks, so you have to meet the definition of instructional weeks. So, Christmas break doesn't count. And then you can use a generic word term, and that can be whatever the heck you want.
We started changing to the word term in our catalog revision that we'll be publishing next. So.
Okay, so do a search for semester.
Yep.
And if it is, you know, semester credit is fine, but the true word of that bucket of semester really, really means something.
Okay.
And then looking at page 404 on what appears to be some sort of an attachment to your
EA, although I'm not entirely sure, because it's page 3 or 4, page 4 or 4, but it wasn't a 1 or 4 or a 2 or 4, so I'm not entirely sure what I'm looking at. But, you have length of term, 1 to 6 weeks, 7 to 10 weeks, and 11 to 16 weeks, so neither of which are the 12 weeks you said your term is.
Is that in the refund policy?
I have no idea.
You know what, I saw it two places. It's there, it's in these pages that are just dangling, I folded two, but I saw it, I think, as well as in the catalog. I saw
it
two places.
Yes, it was in the catalog, but I don't remember where, like, what was it attached to.
I saw it twice.
The refund policy and what that's getting at is the one that's required by the board as well as the one that's required by DEAC. So it might be a formatting error, and we can certainly look at that.
Yeah, it honestly, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. So if the length of term is 1 to 6 weeks, that makes it seem like you could have a term that's 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. So the terms could be anywhere from 1 to 6 weeks. Or you could have some other, the terms of 7 to 10 weeks, and some others where the term is 11 to 16 weeks.
We just copied that directly from DEAC.
Okay, so what they're telling you is that if you had a term that's 1 to 6 weeks, here are your rules.
Right.
If those rules don't apply to you, don't put them in.
Got it.
Okay. So if your term is 12, if you have terms that are 12 weeks and you have terms that are 7 weeks, you would only address a 12-week term and a 7-week term.
Okay, we had been previously advised that we had to state it exactly the way. Like they said, copy and paste do not vary. So we'll
double check with them and just let them know that it caused confusion trying to figure out what you're doing.
Yep.
So, or you have to have some qualifying statement at the beginning that is saying, you know, this at our school, our terms are 12 or whatever, and below is the accrediting. Because as it is, seriously, I could not figure out what you were doing
and
how you were structured in it. Made my head hurt.
Okay. It was the exact same thing. Exactly. Because I was trying to figure out your first course. Because your first course, you allow...
Foundations.
Yeah, is that a 3-week course?
Yes, we're changing
that. So it's
that.
A 3-week course, and that's what I was trying to figure out. Okay, where does that fit? Like, well, and I was sitting there going, is that the only one that's different than 7 or 12? So okay. I was completely confused as well.
And that also is if they all take that 3-week and then they start doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
If it's 3 and then 12 and 7, that's one thing. Or if that 3 is within the 12,
uh-huh.
that's kind of like a different thing. But you have to explain what it is, because when you get all the way up to the feds, you're allowed to have a 3-week module within a 12-week module, a 12-week term without problem. But if you have a 3-week and then a 12-week, 12-week, 7-week, that is a very different application of the rules for you.
Okay.
The next part that I saw was in the students' grievance procedures in it actually says in the procedure number 2, it says, at any time, anyone may obtain the form by emailing the registrar, and then it has the email address from the registrar. But right below it, in the complaint grievance form, it says to access the complaint grievance form, visit the website.
Oh, okay.
So you may want to, and I think I saw that both in this document as well as in the catalog.
So it'll be either or, you know, if they can do either, then say either or.
Okay. It was just, I thought maybe you had updated it.
Okay.
So, go to your catalog.
Did you just finish with Ian?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll add in my EA to keep us on the same topic here. For some reason, new schools really like to have novels as their enrollment agreements.
Oh, novels. Okay, yes. Got it.
And the catalog is part of your enrollment agreement. So in your enrollment agreement, you have a statement saying that this is tied to all the things that are in your catalog. So you don't have to repeat everything from your catalog in your EA. And I'm not telling you that you can't have your EA. I'm just saying that historically what I've seen is it becomes intimidating mm-hmm. to have a 9 or 15-page enrollment agreement. And then you update something in your catalog, and you forget to update your enrollment agreement. Now we have a legal conflict. So you don't have to make it smaller, but you might want to look at it to see. But if you're going to keep it this long, it has to be page 1 of 9, 2 of 9, 3 of 9, and then we recommend that you have a student initial each one so that later they can't say, you slipped different pages.
Sure.
No, that wasn't my page 1,
okay.
my page 2.
Thank you for that. One of the reasons that our EA is the way that it is, because we're trying very hard to follow compliance from both the board and also the DEAC, and so we'll look at ways to streamline and make it more efficient and
Yeah, you can also with other peers at DAC, you know, when you went to the conference, you know, the schools are all very generous as long as they're not a direct competitor of you.
Right.
You know, so if you met some people there, you'd get some feedback and mm-hmm. that type of thing. And on page 4 of UVA, you state that assistance may be available to those who qualify through private lenders until such time as Title IV funds become available. That sounds like a promise to me, like you are going to get Title IV, and there is no promise of that. So okay. As a student, I'm going to look at it and say, oh, I'm sure they'll get it by the time I leave, and then mm-hmm. they'll come and complain to us and say they dangled that carrot. So you need to make a clear statement that you do not participate in Title IV. Okay. Course withdrawal, this was just a question. Maybe I was being too literal, but this is on page 6. After the first week of instruction and prior to the final day of instruction, a student may request withdrawal from a course. A withdrawal may only be granted if the request to withdraw is received within the stated time frame and the student has a passing status. So I'm failing that course, mm-hmm. so I want to withdraw from it and take it later. Apparently, I'm getting really punished because I'm failing. I can't withdraw, and I just have to tough it out. Did you mean to do that?
No.
That's how I read it. So you might want to look at that okay. wording and make sure. That's now, what you could have, what many schools have, is they have a withdrawal passing and a withdrawal failure. And, you know, that may influence how it's included in your GPA. Mm-hmm. Like, you may have that a withdrawal passing would be considered in your progression, so they did take that many courses and they did successfully complete it, but maybe a withdrawal passing is neutral in the GPA, but a withdrawal failure counts against in the GPA. That type of thing.
Right.
Again, you might want to ask some peers, but that just seems to me.
Okay.
On page 7, this is another application of the word that you use. You can have a refund policy that is course by course. So if I take one, he takes two, and she takes three, depending on where we withdraw from the course, we would just get the refund be applied, you know, to just the course. So if he's in three and he withdraws from one, it goes against that one.
Mm-hmm.
But in some places, you're talking about withdrawing from a course, and sometimes you're talking about withdrawing from a term.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, schools decide if they are going to say, okay, within this term, for Title IV purposes, you're not a withdrawal unless you withdraw from all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But for your institutional refund policy, you can have it that for each individual course, you apply refund policy, and that's fine. Or you can say, once you start it, unless you withdraw from the whole term. But then you state it, clearly saying, the withdrawal policy goes against each individual course, even if the student remains enrolled, that type of thing.
Okay.
So go through and look for the places where you talked about that and pick it. And sometimes when you're looking, like, at the DAC rules, they may have a bit of a smorgasbord there because they know schools are doing things different. So make sure you're not copy and pasting, this rule applies to those who do it by course, and this one applies to those who do it by term, and you're mixing it, and therefore you can't actually apply it.
Okay.
That was the last one I had on here.
The errata sheet.
Mm-hmm.
I viewed this as a version record. So when the students are accessing a handbook or a manual, typically what I've seen, or from my experience, I have seen where the change is explained, but the date that change has been made. The reason being is you have a list here of 217 changes, but I can't imagine they were all changed on the same day. And so if I'm trying to track down a policy, I thought it was something, and I will never tell, because this is going over what I assume to be an academic year, so by the time you get to the end of the academic year, it gets unwieldy on that. So I would just maybe just give you the helpful suggestion
sure.
of making sure you just put with the changes and the
okay.
date that's changed.
And if possible, to have that in the end instead of in the beginning, because I was kind of going, are you kidding me? No table of contents? What the heck is this? And I had to go through many pages. You know, it's page 11 before you get a table of contents. So I felt like you were like one of those fancy magazines that you have to look at all those ads before you get to the first.
Okay. My next one is on 23.
My next one's on 21. Oh, I think you answered already. Did you say you're doing Sarah? That one was at the side of the school.
We can't do Sarah until we're accredited, so we are state by state.
Do you plan to?
Oh, yes.
And so mine was in the same section. I was impressed, actually, with how much homework that you guys have done here. The only question I had on page 23 was you actually had a section of states, Alabama, Delaware, D.C., Indiana, and Mississippi, where you say you were reviewing
the process.
So, but that does not indicate whether or not you are allowing students to enroll there or not.
Okay.
I don't know that I understood that.
So what if we have, when we're stating that we're reviewing the process, it means that we've reached out to every single state that we believe we are eligible to enroll, and there are certain states that have not and just continue to not reply back to us, and so it's truly impossible for us to gain clarification on whether or not it's legal to enroll in their state. Indiana is one of them, and I'm from Indiana, which makes me very angry. but so we want to be truthful with students, and so when they call, we state to them, look, we've reached out to your state, and we've done our due diligence, and we have documentation to prove that we have. And so what we would like to do is reach out on your behalf as a student and state that we have a student who's interested in registering at CGI, and we would like to know if we can get somebody on the phone today who can verify. They won't reply to us for whatever reason. So.
And I'm very familiar with state compliance. In my experience, I've always just restricted them. Okay. I haven't enrolled students in the state if mm-hmm. I can't legitimately prove that we are eligible to do business there.
Right.
So if they change the wording here, say that something, so the students know that it doesn't hurt to ask, so in case something has changed since you published it, mm-hmm. they could ask, but they would know that if they're from, you know, Alabama, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. understanding that before they start making a lot of plans, they need to reach out. So maybe just change that one little sentence to explain what it means.
Okay, sure.
But you did do, I was very, very impressed with all of what you did.
We also have a map on our website that students can scroll over, and it tells them exactly where we're at in the process.
Then, you know, in your catalog, if you do that too, maybe just put the link to that that page. That would be great.
It yep. used to be there. I'll check for it again.
My next one was on 25.
I don't have to look through.
Okay. So there's a whole section on questions, and I found this interesting. I guess I was just looking to the board too, being a newbie here. It says, any questions a student may have regarding this catalog that have not been satisfactorily answered by Cummings Institute may be directed to AZPPSB.
I thought that wasn't
a good idea.
We're not going to answer.
They're not going to. It's you're going to have the same thing with creditors, because if students are looking for an answer they can't get and they see like accreditation on their website, they will contact your creditor asking questions about you, and it doesn't bode well. It's going to flood the staff with things that
sure.
they're going to pull their hair out.
So just remove.
So, I mean, you need to be able to answer, I would think, you need to be able to answer any questions about your catalog.
Our intent was not that they contact the board. Our intent was that they understand they have the option of contacting the board, similar to the grievance policy, but it clearly
yeah, I don't think those are related.
Not
yeah,
I wouldn't say they're related at all.
Yeah. And your complaints is right below, and it says the same thing. So I was like, here it's appropriate, there not so much.
Okay. It might have been a revision formatting kind of thing, too, so.
So my next one is on 30, and it's institute calendar and term schedule. And we already talked about how I was having trouble following the story. But even once you are clear about defining your terms, when you say institute operates continuously with terms beginning throughout the year, a lot of schools literally have every week, every month, every 3 weeks, a term starts and that cohort goes like this. Mm-hmm. If you have that, cool. If you don't have that, and you don't have terms starting throughout the year, you have three starts
okay.
a year. So just say whatever you mean. And we're highly motivated to, once approved, not have you come before the complaint committee. So we're harder on you during this and during renewals so you don't show up in the complaint committee. Mm-hmm. And trust me, you don't want to.
No, I appreciate it. We can certainly, these are easy edits, so we have no problem.
And then, admittedly, I'm old. I could not read this page 31.
Calendar.
And I know that they
can't read that.
And you had the link, so I did boot up from the computer and I went to the link. But I kind of feel like don't bother putting something in that your average, say, middle-aged person. Couldn't read.
So just provide the link.
Right.
So the link is enough. The link is enough.
Well, it's nice, actually, if you have, but maybe instead of putting this whole thing, if you have three starts a year, your calendar is list okay. the three dang starts. List your holidays. It is nice to have this picture thing, like on the catalog, but I mean on the website we can't make it bigger. But if you're not going to make this as big enough to read it, it has no value.
Okay.
Here and I was hunting for a time, like where exactly are the stars? What is this shading thing? I can't read it. So I'm not the only one that could read that.
I can't.
And it was very ungentlemanly of you to point out that I'm older than just saying.
I apologize, Madam Chair.
You don't want to come work like me either. Oh, you're
right.
All right, 36, go.
I wanted to clarify because in admissions on page 36, it talks about degree seeking and non-degree. So you'll allow students to take one course at a time without being enrolled up to so many courses, and then they either have to enroll or they stop, or they can just be...
The non-degree process is stated in the catalog. Is it on that same page that you're looking at?
Degree seeking admissions. And non-degree was a few pages later, but I was trying to understand your model more mm-hmm. than
how we do the non-degree admissions.
Yeah.
We haven't yet had a non-degree student start, but what we were trying to firm up was that they can, you know, begin and take one course at a time if they'd like. Over six consecutive semesters, they can take up to six classes, and then they need to make a decision at that point if they want to continue on as a DBH student, because we don't offer any other programs or options.
Do they have to take them also in order of the sequence of the curriculum was built? Like, they couldn't come in and take your project class at first?
No, the project is not an option. They do have to take foundations, and they can take, as long as they've taken Biodyne 1, which is the foundations of Biodyne 1 are required for all students, including non-degree, because it's a prerequisite to everything else that we offer. So as long as they've taken those two classes, they can choose from other courses that only have foundations of Biodyne 1 as a prereq.
Why don't you just put in a qualifying statement saying that they're the choices of courses yeah. they may enroll in are limited, and then tell them what department or what link, if you like, have a list of classes or something, whatever.
Okay.
And that's nice that you have that, because it could be someone who is in the field and doesn't need or want the whole degree, but needs to have some personal knowledge on something. So it's nice that you offer it.
Continuing professional development.
Yeah, professional development. It's really nice you have it. Just, again, we don't mm-hmm. come from the complaint community. And
sure.
funny enough, we would have to say that's not the part that we are actually licensing. It would be that piece, but they would undoubtedly want to come and complain to us anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
So just put it all there.
Okay.
On that same page, you have the Title IX section, which is fantastic. But as part of that regulation, you have to designate a Title IX coordinator, and typically their contact information would be contained in that section.
Okay.
And then finally on the bottom of that page, and maybe it was me reading this late at night, but I didn't understand under professional licensure and admissions. Oh, I thought maybe you should, you started all of a sudden, I think all of a sudden, it could be me, using the acronym of DBH, and I'm not sure that, you know what I mean, like usually you sprinkle it, so I was late at night, I was trying to go back and figure it out.
What a DBH
that might have been
is.
Me.
Okay.
But
so which page was that?
That was on the bottom of 36.
Okay.
Dr. Benjamin.
Yeah, but it took me a minute, but I had circled it because all of a sudden I think we started referring. I don't
sure.
know, it was just to me.
We
I don't
can
know,
spell
it
out.
I aligned it. On 37, mm-hmm. you don't have anything on 37? I thought it was interesting under degree-seeking admission process that the required documentation would include both the unofficial and the official transcripts.
I'm sorry, could you...
It's on 37, under degree-seeking admission process. You
uh-huh.
have a list of documents and... Two
oh,
in a row
okay.
are unofficial and official.
So the reason in the application process we have them upload their unofficial, because it gives us a sense for if they're trying to transfer any credits, or if they're asking us if, you know, if they want us to consider any of their credit transcript, excuse me, if they want us to consider any of their courses that they've taken in transfer, we want to know that right away and begin talking to them about what our rules are. And it also gives us a chance to get a preview of what their unofficial transcripts are before the institution that they're requesting transcripts from provides the official, because sometimes that process can be quite lengthy. And so it helps us in the admissions process continue on the conversation. We'll know pretty much right away whether or not they're going to be admitted based on the unofficial, and then we can't admit them officially until we get the official, but at least it gives us an opportunity to know where they're going to be at.
So you're looking at their GPA or whatever in the master's program typically, not for transfer coursework if they don't.
Correct. And then if they're coming in from a non-behavioral health degree, a nurse, for example, we want to know if they've taken any behavioral health courses, because they won't be able to go right into Biodyne 1 without having some master's degree level behavioral health courses. And so it allows us to really get a glimpse of what they've taken to prepare for entry.
Can I suggest then that if you make this as a qualifier, that part of the application process, they must give you the unofficial transcripts?
Yeah.
And then put in a deadline that if accepted, the enroll process isn't complete until the official is there, or must be given by a certain time frame. Because I work with some schools that will say unofficial is accepted for admissions, and then they'll say you must provide the official within 12 weeks of the start. And now the student goes past the 12 weeks, they're being held out of class, they didn't do the official, the students are thinking, well, I'm free and clear, I'm done. So just make it very clear when they must have that official. And if it is before they, you know, take the first class, make it very clear that they will not be allowed to take the class without the official.
Okay.
But because the old must in Maine, if you're going to make exceptions, make sure that you say something unless special admission by whatever. So if some reason, like if it turns out it's from a closed school or something, so you're making some exceptions for them. Mm-hmm. But if you're not going to make any exceptions, then say that there's no exceptions and then you can't make any exceptions.
Okay, got it.
I was just visiting a school who felt that they had professional judgment to override any of their own policies. Yes, I was there with a team of lawyers, so you don't want that.
Right.
My next one's related to page 48. So this is between 48 and 51, and I think this may just be some clarification. Because under course repetition, a second failed grade in any course required for graduation may lead to academic dismissal. But under graduate level course grade requirement, if the student receives a second D or F grade in the retake course, they will be dismissed from the institution. So I understand what you're doing there.
Right.
But
I think that language is clarified in our next version that's coming out here in the next month or so. Okay. I'll look into that.
Okay.
Thank you.
My next one's page 54.
Oh, yeah.
Am I good? Okay. And on page 54, leave of absence is something that I always pay attention to because I just find that, people just always mess it up. At first, you do have a typo. You have a confirmation of the decision. So
okay.
That'll be better. You have it, first, back up. For leave of absences, schools always have to make the decision of whether a student is allowed to take their leave during a term or only upon the completion of a term.
Okay.
If they're allowed to do it, if you have multiple courses within a term, like they're taking 2 6-week courses, maybe you let them take a leave if they're not in the middle of a course, you let them take it for like, you know, half term type thing. You just have to make those decisions, and whatever you decide is fine. You just have to say it. Ultimately, when you have Title IV, it's very difficult to offer leave during a term unless you have modules. If you have uncompleted courses, it's the way the Department of Ed rules are, it makes it very difficult to offer midterm leave.
Okay.
And if you need to explain if there's going to be any cost involved. So like the feds say, if you give a student leave of absence, it cannot result in any cost. So if you decide to let a student leave in the middle of the fall term, when they come back in the spring, you can't charge them more. They've already paid for terms. So you can't charge them more. So some schools then will just waive their tuition for the fall and just charge them for the spring, or they waive the tuition for the spring and just charge for whatever, but you have to have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
If your plan involves that if they're in the middle of a term, they will be charged, then you're not giving them a leave that term, and they must, and you would state leaves are not allowed during a term, the student need to withdraw, but they may request relief for the following term.
Okay.
But whatever you want to say, you just say it, but make sure that it's very clear.
Okay.
Your SAS ready progress. is nowhere near what the feds would require, and I don't...
For Title IV?
For Title IV.
Okay.
And I don't have the DEAC one memorized. I was at the conference too, but I wasn't focusing on that particular thing. So just check the DEAC rules to see what it is, but you might want to look at what the feds are. Granted, not leading in whether you do or don't get Title IV, but they have a very robust satisfactory progress requirements that say what happens if you withdraw and come back. You're allowed to have what they call like a restart. If a student withdraws and comes back, you can say they can start fresh, or you can say they must return on status they were before. You specify whether all the grades they took are going to count, or is it only going to be the grades that you're accepting upon return? All of those things you have to specify. So you can have the guy who's doing court, he stays out of here, comes back in, and he thinks he's starting with a clean slate, but you are making him roll over, and based on how poorly you did the first time, he'll never be able to get.
Right.
So you have a nice little, a paragraph in two sentences. It's not going to cover all situations that are going to come up, so you might want to just think about making that more robust, just to protect yourself so everybody knows.
Sure.
The minimum GPA of 3, make sure you're clearly saying that if they get below a 3, are they being kicked out at the end of that term? Are they being given a period to bring it up, and if so, how long of a period? And again, a school that I was just visiting, they had a drop dead that if they had below, it was a 2.5, they were kicked out, but they didn't figure out the grades until 3 weeks into the next term. And so the student had already started the terms, and now they were kicked out, and they'd already paid for the dorm for the, it was very, very complicated. So just think about what you're doing, and if they have to have the 3, if they don't have the 3, do you give them one term to get back up, or is it immediate death, like whatever.
Okay.
Under course completion, students may not enroll in additional coursework until they have resolved incompletes. So I was there at that 12-week term. I had all incompletes. So am I sitting out that entire next term? Since you have multiple courses in the term, am I allowed to enroll later? It's a perfectly fine statement. It's not normally what I see. Mm-hmm. Normally I see that if a student has an incomplete, they're given X amount of time to complete that.
Mm-hmm.
But however you want to do it, it's fine. Just make sure that it's clear that people know how they're matriculating on. Mm-hmm. And some of this is, this is all part of your satisfactory progress section, I see, actually. But the maximum time frame, you're not saying when it is you're checking it. You're just saying they have to complete it in 5 years. So do you let them go all the way to 5 and say, oh, too bad, so sad you didn't do it? Are you checking at the end of every term? Are you checking at the end of every calendar year, at the end of every academic year? Say when it is you're doing it.
Okay.
So my notes are right there around maximum and a minimum. I'm going to go back and recommend that you really rethink even putting a minimum of 2 years. If it's physically impossible for someone to do, to state it can set the expectation that someone can do it, and when they don't do it, they let people know.
Okay.
Okay, so they'll start to go to your state agency or your accreditor and complain about that.
Okay.
And then when really thinking about the maximum term, so if I understand your format right, you're really talking that you're thinking students are completing 18 credits a year, correct? 666, right? And so it's really going to take them 3 years to even get to, and that's provided they go, right? They don't ever take a term off, right? It's going to take them 3 years just to get to the coursework. And then I start to think about projects, and I can't imagine your projects run concurrently. You can't take two project courses typically at the same time. Generally, a project is 1-1-1. When you get to the end, if it's anything like a doctoral dissertation or anything, right?
Right, correct.
And so they now you're getting into year 4. And by limiting to 5 years, you're really going to end up with some situations, especially when you know that the average time to a doctoral degree is 8.5 years. And it may not be, but you're not allowing anyone to take off a term or anything. They're going to get to the end because there's not enough time. And if you want them to take one at a time, it's just much longer. That's at 2 a time.
1.5 times is kind of a norm. Unless you have, like ABA has a 84-month maximum. So you have to build that in. But if you if your field doesn't have a particular maximum, if you put 1.5, since that's sort of like a norm, you still can say this is the maximum, but the expectation is students would generally complete within 5, so the students don't think, oh, I can take 7. So if it's 4, then 1.5 would be 6. Like whatever the case is, but what happens is if you have a policy, it's a drop-dead thing. And when you have the maximum time frame of 5, at each evaluation point, you have to say, are they progressing at the rate to finish in 5? At the point where they're not progressing at the rate, you actually are supposed to do something about them then,
right,
not wait to the end.
Right.
So just make sure you're not getting rid of the good students, but at the same time, you're keeping them on track. You're letting them know, hey, at the pace you're going, it's going to take you 6.5 years, so we need to put you on notice of what is your plan.
Right.
You know, maybe you need to have two courses next term, whatever it is.
Right.
I mean, at 9 credits alone, they're not going to finish in 5 years. And if their project is more complicated or whatever, and they need, say, an extra, I mean, I didn't see any continuation courses, but having experience with doctoral, you might want to think about that, too. These time frames, I don't know that will meet your students' expectations like the PQ
and
KMI. And
when you get to Title IV, they end up wanting to know what is your, what is the norm.
You also might want to consider an appeal process even when you set that time frame. If they're like well into their project and stuff, then they need some extra time. And then I was equally as interested is if you're, are you evaluating SAP at the end of each term? So at the end of 12 weeks, and then when you come to the 7, it's at the end of 7. Isn't there something with term-based where they have to be at a certain number of weeks and a certain number of credits before you run SAP? And can it be at uneven intervals of 12, 12, and 7?
The feds have rules. We have to check where the EAC is. You're saying you're doing it at the end of every term?
We do.
And it says they will meet at least once following the close of each term to review it. So at least once. I don't know when it would be more than once. But you have to have something that builds in to say what proration you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So if you have the 5 years or you change it to whatever, at each evaluation point, you're checking the GPA. You're checking against that maximum calendar time frame, and then you're also going to get whatever percentage because of failed courses, like typical is 0.667 of the credits attempted. This is what they've completed, and all three of those things being checked at each evaluation point. And you don't have to do every term. I personally like it when it's done every term because otherwise the students go on kind of too long before they know. So I think it's great to have them at the term. But then you typically would then say what happens if they don't make it. Mm-hmm. Are they on like a warning for the next term?
Right.
They have to have a
that should be all spelled out in the catalog. If it's not, I'll touch back.
Could be somewhere different
again, but
and if it is somewhere different, just refer them to them. You know.
Okay.
Tell them where to find it.
Okay.
My last comment.
Oh, hang on a second. You have academic one, academic probation, but you didn't tie in. So in this evaluation schedule, when you're saying check every term, then you'd have to say a student may be put on warning or probation, and then they would know they could go to something to link.
Okay.
And they say it there. Student doesn't gain SAP, the student will be automatically SAP is met, next schedule. So they have to tie it in, you're right.
Yeah, okay. And also keep in mind that when you say you will dismiss them, that remember you're taking away your power to have any exception. So if you would give an exception, like again this case I was just on, they felt the student was almost there, so they gave an extra term, but their policy said they would dismiss them.
Okay.
And then that person stayed for 5 more terms, all of which they were not supposed to be there. So you want, just make sure you're very clear about, you want it to seem threatening to make the student feel like he really has to do that, but if you want an out clause, you have to give it to yourself. And if you don't give it yourself, don't take it.
Okay.
So, and keep in mind that sometimes when you finally go through the tough board, when they lose their aid, or if you're giving scholarships, when they lose their scholarship, may be different than when you actually make them leave school. So if any of these are tied to like some sort of merit scholarship or something, you can have them lose their merit scholarship and still have to stay at school if you have them.
No. My last one is on 58.
Yep. I think I might be done.
My last one is about instructor withdrawal of a student for disruptive behavior.
Page 58.
Page 58. My I just wanted to throw out some thoughts for this one, which is the instructor can unilaterally remove a student from class with a W or an F. If there is Title IV someday in the future, you could have some Title IV problems with that. Depending on when students withdraw, there's or they're dismissed, there's, you know, R2T4s and all sorts of things. And then my other concern from an academic perspective is that there tends to be, unless you're doing some type of norming, inconsistent ideas of what disruptive behavior could be. Mm-hmm. And so with an instructor to be able to do that, it has such significant impact on a student. I think you may need to think about a bigger process than you're being disruptive, you're out, mm-hmm. and them and faculty typically don't understand all the rules that are behind the student record.
Okay. And this is a separate question that strikes me. Do you consider yourself like attendance taking that the student has to be participating in every single thing, or is it more?
EAC requires us to report on attendance. However, what we do is we take course progress. We can track pretty much anything that they do, and anytime that they're logging in, how long that they're in, you know, certain areas, what modules they viewed, and so what we do is we collect an attendance report weekly, and those get sent to both the instructors as well as the advisors and the retention committee. And so we do review attendance. To students, we tell them, you know, we basically publish, I believe, in our catalog and also in our syllabus that student success tips are that they need to be logging in at least 3 to 5 times a week. Because, you know, news and announcements, things that are going to be important for them to be keeping track of, in addition to, I'm a doctoral student, I work full-time, I plan to come in on the weekend only and get everything done in that weekend. Well, how is that doable if you don't know what you're going to be doing that week, or if there's a new, you know, discussion board post that you need to respond to? So we give them and we advise them within the course and certainly within the webinars that are live and synchronous that they need to be logging in much more often than just once per week.
So again, when you get down the road to Department of Ed, logging in and attendance are not the same thing.
Right.
And I know that in a live class, you can come in and put your head down on the desk and you signed in and you're there and you technically have attended. But in online, it doesn't work that way. So make sure your system is such that if they're logging in was actually to contact someone to say I'm quitting, that login would absolutely not count as an active related activity. Turning it on and not, you know, moving the mouse or answering any of the questions during, you know, a live lecture, whatever, that counts as logging in, but doesn't really count as doing something. So make sure you're familiar with both the DEAC and truly the Department of Ed's rules as well, just so that, again, you're building it in and you don't have to make it sloppy about it.
Yeah.
Because I have seen program reviews in the department where the school said, here, all the attendants, Department of Ed person picked some things, and literally that was the case that the student was contacting the teacher saying, I want to quit, how do I do it?
Mm-hmm.
And they calculated as attendance, and it didn't go well.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, then I'll make a motion to approve the provisional degree granting license renewal for Cummings Graduate Institute for Behavioral Health Studies with the stipulations that $100,000 surety bond be maintained and to continue quarterly reporting financial reports.
We agree to those terms.
Would it be appropriate for them to buy snacks for everybody?
I feel like you should be buying some snacks for us right now.
Yeah, you know what? You got this free education.
Okay.
You got this free consulting. So you did agree?
You do agree to the terms.
And do you have the authority to agree?
I do.
That's
the
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
You guys opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to be sad if they're not coming back.
I'm going to be the conference consultant.
Yeah.
Well, the confusing part is they're still a non-accredited institution. So what we're reviewing from the checklist and what they have is compared to what was approved last year compared to what they have now, which is a non-accredited institution. And a lot of the stuff that they have, they cut and paste stuff from Department of Ed, which they're not accredited yet. So I'm not sure if they should have two separate enrollment agreements, one that we look at before you get it to show they're not accredited, and then another one that they're going to use when they get accredited.
That because has caused confusion in some of the other things.
Because 70% of what comes up, it looks like I didn't read any of this. And I'm like, I read this thing, and I talked to her about the DEAC information on the enrollment agreement. She said they told us to cut and paste the whole thing. So that's an accredited thing, and they go by that compliance and not by a non-accredited institution. So if they would give us one that would have what they are now that we review.
As long as they're going to use it, because if they...
They shouldn't be using the one that they're not accredited yet. They shouldn't be using the one that has all this DEAC stuff and all that in there.
Unless
it just
those policies are stricter than ours, you welcome them.
Yeah, but
the problem is we're not looking at it the same way you and Jennifer just are looking at it.
We're looking at it as...
I'm not looking at it for Title IV reasons,
and that's why I was confused.
And so it looks real kind of like, wow.
They're not on Title IV yet, so I was wondering why we're going down this road. But I guess it was just...
Honestly, the other school we have that has the two schools, they were going down that path, and they have so many things that they didn't change, so now they didn't come back every couple months for years.
Okay.
And I feel like if we had, at the beginning, made sure that they were on the right path, we would have saved an ungodly amount of effort.
I think you're
so
right.
So that was a lot of information given to this school.
Yeah,
that
you
if
did
they
them
don't,
a big favor.
If they don't go forward, fine. But also, next year when they come back, if they have not made changes we've suggested, we say, you know, where's your administrative ability? All these suggestions were made.
Fair.
We still have these typos, whatever. So I have found it helpful. And when you guys put all those notes, so people who are not even on the board anymore, and when you give us the reports and you have the things,
yeah.
And say this person asked, that person asked,
yeah.
I always check to make sure they have done that. And I think it tells a lot about their administrative capability.
You're right.
You are. Let's go. We're wiggling down here, folks. All right. Next class. Additional to regular location program license renewal, clinical research fast track. And the lead is you.
Just very briefly, Madam Chair, members of the board, at your January 28th meeting, the board approved the conditional vocational app for clinical research fast track with the stipulation that the $15,000 charity bond be maintained. They are now seeking to go from conditional regular. Lewis and David, low.
No,
also.
This is not Lewis.
Also own National Laser, which has been licensed by the board since 2006. Again, your board member lead is Mr. Clark.
Hi, welcome, and thanks for your ungodly amount of patience.
Thank you.
I'll try to make this quick. Hey, unless would you like to make any statements to us?
I would. I was going to start out with good morning.
Well, you have to introduce yourself. For the record, please.
Yeah. My name is David Silberman. I'm the CEO of Clinical Research Fast Track.
Hi. I'm Lauren Belina. I'm the Program Director at Clinical Research Fast Track.
Okay. Thank you.
And thank you all for having us. I appreciate it. And I actually appreciate all that you do. I know it can be a long process, but I think there is a real valid purpose for this board and making sure schools are acting appropriately and doing what they're supposed to be doing. And also, I've worked with Terry and Keith for a long time now, and it's been a great pleasure working with them. They've always been responsive to questions and helpful when needed. And so I just want the board to know that it is a pleasure working with them. Clinical So Clinical Research Fast Track is a program that trains clinical research coordinators and people moving into the clinical research industry. And just so that you all have a little bit of background, what that is before a medical device or a treatment or a drug can be approved for use by a hospital or a doctor and prescribed to us all, and we've all taken medicines before it's prescribed, it has to go through what's called a clinical trial. And we hear about these FDA phase one, phase two, phase three trials. And these trials are critically important to make sure that we're getting drugs that are safe and effective. And that's what this is all about, safe and effective. Now, the interesting thing is, in this profession, it used to be doctors and nurses who would run these trials, and you still have doctors who are the principal investigators of the trials, but it's become more and more regulated and specialized, and the FDA oversees it. Fewer nurses are doing these activities, and they've assigned clinical research coordinators to run the trial. So these people are enrolling patients in the studies, they're collecting data, they're going through this whole process of the drug approval process, the trial, and there's currently, there's not an exact certificate to become, to get into that role. So people are often pulled from a research job, a nursing job, a medical assistant job, and said, hey, can you run these trials? They don't always know what they're doing, and there's a lack of training in the industry. There is two certification bodies, and those bodies will give you certification. Lauren just got hers last year, right? But you have to be working in the field for 2 years before you sit for the certifying exam. So there's this gap in training. So we have developed a training program for people to enter into the field. There's lots of jobs out there, but no one wants to hire anyone unless they know what they're doing. They want the certified people who've been doing it for 2 years or more, but how do you get started in the industry? And that's why we developed our program to help people get that boot camp training they need just to get enough experience and knowledge so an employer's confident to hire them to start out in the industry. That's who we are. We were approved last year, as you mentioned, on January 28th. We couldn't even advertise until that time, as you all know. So we had our very first class in June. We have what's called a boot camp training program, so it's currently 8 days of classroom instruction. They're long days. Our instructors are all clinical research coordinators, associate supervisors. They're amazing people. They come from the Mayo Clinic, from Banner Health, from Honor Health, Clinical Oncology, Phoenix Children's Hospital. They come in for 1 day to teach one of those 8 days. So the students are getting expert curriculum delivered by all these really fascinating, great people who are in the industry. Then there's online post-study for another 68 hours, so they get post-study, and then they go into a two-week internship at a local clinical trial site where they can see what they've learned, and they can see it in real life, because what you learn in the books and in class, in real life, it's a little different. And then after that, hopefully they're job-ready and they can move into jobs. So since we first met, we've had 47 students enroll in our program. I know you're, Mr. Tharp, you're looking, you're like, oh, I only see four students. Well, that was in June.
I see 23 total.
Well, we have a class going on right now. So now we've had 47. So the number goes up each month, of course. And they're in various stages of enrollment, of classroom, online, or internship. We've got 26 who've completed the course. We have 16 who are currently employed directly as clinical research coordinators or research assistants in the field or monitors in really great jobs, and many are applying and getting jobs right now. So we're really excited about the progress of the program. It's going well, and we're excited to be here.
Great. Thank you. That is a unique niche. You don't see that too often. Mm-hmm. With that. Looking at your fiscal year ending summaries, your income was pretty negative. How are you able to sustain, and how many students do you need to get to break even?
So our break even right now is 8 students and per month. So it's 8 students per month, and we're currently enrolling very close to that. So in this, our year is a calendar year, so our financials go from January to December. And this year we have a slight burn rate, so we're not quite profitable, but we anticipate being profitable by the third quarter, possibly the fourth quarter. So in terms of our revenues and our growth trajectory, it's not as fast as we would like.
Do you have the funds to sustain that?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, so right now, my brother Lewis, who's not here, and I, we are self-funding the company. We've been solicited by investors to invest in our company. We prefer not to take on investors. And at this rate, we would never need investors, maybe at a later date. But I don't see any problem on the financial side whatsoever.
Okay.
Answered my student loan question, so I think I can go. Your enrollment agreement looks pretty good, and it was only 4 pages, so I don't really have any comments on that. I like the brevity of it.
So I have a question about that. What we turn into you, you asked that we label where everything goes on the enrollment agreement, right?
Thank God.
And that's what we turn to you. What we give to our students, of course, doesn't have those labels.
Yeah, we know that.
And we actually made it pretty, and it's 3 pages instead of 4, because, you know.
Yeah, yeah. If he didn't do this for me, I'd be very angry, right? Because it makes my job.
Yeah,
when I get applications asked for Stansfield, I'm less than happy that are not cross-referenced.
The one the students see is a lot prettier, though.
Well, yeah, I don't look aesthetically. I look for information, and it has all the information that I required on it, but that's a nice touch, yes. So I hope it is.
Can I ask one question about the enrollment agreement?
Yeah, anybody got it? Before I go to the catalog, they want to go to the
This has to do with the refund policy.
Uh-huh.
As written, you're saying that if the student cancels at more than 3 days, then they haven't started yet, they get everything back. So you're not going to keep any kind of a fee?
If they enroll in the class...
Okay, so say they enroll on Monday, and then the following Monday, they say, I'm not going to start, and I put $100 down. Are you going to retain the $100 fee, or are you going to get
at this money? Point in time, that has happened, and we've refunded everybody.
That's what you're saying, and I just want to make sure it is in fact what you were doing, because you are allowed after 3 days to keep a fee.
Keep a fee.
We're not making you keep it, but as worded, you're saying that you're not keeping it. Whereas if once they started, you are keeping the $100 administrative fee is part of the refund policy, but not part of the people who never start. So if that's your intention, that's cool.
Yeah, right now that is our intention. We may change that in the future.
It's nice of you to do it that way, right?
Yeah, it's nice.
But they'll come to the complaint committee and you said you wouldn't. So, yeah, sure, I'll keep you out of here.
Yeah. We don't want to come here. No offense.
And Dagan.
Your catalog also is looked well. You know, it's not giant, which is good, but you're on a singular program, so that's it. And I went through all these, but I did have a couple notes. On page 6 of your catalog, under externships, total externship units 80 hours, but then you said students may shorten their externship by 40 hours, so it doesn't give me any explanation of why, and that's
so
odd if you said the requirement's 80.
We made a change, and so I'm glad you're asking that. Maybe you can help us out with it. Many of our students are professionals, and they're working, and we wanted to give them the option to shorten their internship from 2 weeks to 1. Once they've taken the class, they've gone through all the material, they go in the internship, it's really about just being in that work environment, seeing everything. 2 weeks is better than 1, but a lot of these people are working, and their goal is to get a better job, right, to move into this career. They're taking PTO for the first week of class, then they got to take PTO for the next week of the internship, and getting that extra week off for them is difficult. That's why we said, maybe they should just take a 1.
Well, then you should change your requirements.
And say 1 week required.
You say the externship units are 40 hours with the option to do an additional 40 hours.
We will do it
the time first.
Okay.
Because this way, I'm going to hold you accountable to say everybody needs to do 80 hours.
Okay.
So you want to say they need to do 40, but they do have the option to do an additional 40 hours. Okay. So just.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What you're saying. At the bottom of page 6, I know this is rather nitpicky of me, but it says applicants must be 21 years of age and have at least 2 years of college or have an LVN or medical assistant degree. I'm quite sure you mean diploma, since by nature the LVN is a diploma program.
Is it a license or diploma? Yes. Sorry, we'll put that down.
So put a medical assistant, LVN or medical assistant diploma.
Okay.
There are medical assistant degrees out there. That would limit your people. Did you have anything on page 7?
Page 9 is the first one.
Yeah. or anybody else in charge. Okay, page 9. Students are expected to arrive in time for class with proper materials. An overall attendance rate of 86% is required. Students may request to withdraw, or instructor may request to withdraw from the course if the absence exceeds 20% or tardiness exceeds. So, I don't know. I guess if this is required, but it's still up to the school whether they drop them or not. Is there a provision for them to make that up? That's page 9 in the academic policies.
So, we're
talking about 80% is required, but if they get over 20%, that may withdraw. So, is that year? I mean, I'm just trying to get where you want to leave.
You got
I'm,
me
I'm,
and
I'm sorry, what, where are you on the page? I'm trying
at the very
to
last
very bottom page. No.
80% is required, but that they may request your withdrawal after 20%. It doesn't match up. If 80% is required,
then required,
they must.
Then you may for 20%. I'm just throwing that. If I was a student, I wouldn't know what that means.
If 80% is required, then they kind of must request survey.
Well, you're saying it's an overall attendance rate of 80%, and then you're saying, apparently on an individual course basis, instructors may request a withdrawal if it exceeds 20%. You just need more words there to explain what's going on. So if they...
do they have to make it up?
Yeah, they have to make it up.
Right.
Is there a provision to make it up?
100% in one course and,
yes,
you know, 60% in another course, is that okay? Or just explain better.
Right.
And also it says, or tardiness exceeds 5 days.
Right.
But up at the top, 1C, you're saying the student will be withdrawn if they are out for 3 days?
3 consecutive days.
Right.
So it's 3 consecutive or 5 total days.
No, that says 5 tardiness. That's a whole nother.
Oh, sorry, that's tardiness.
So that means if I'm late 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes,
well,
2 minutes,
well,
then you're going to kick me out?
No.
Just clarify so that nobody has a
tardiness meaning more missing more than X number of minutes.
Well, it says, yeah, your instructors may request your withdrawal from the course program if absences exceed 20% or tardiness exceeds 5 days.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that sentence in itself, may, but it's the 80% is required above that. That is my problem. If it's required, do you give it up?
Okay, so 80% is required to pass.
If it's required.
Overall. Their overall attendance for the program has to be 80%.
Right.
I hear what you're saying.
Right.
And maybe sometimes they'll have a course or part where they'll be 70% attending, another one they'll be 90%. They'll still hit that 80%, but
okay,
you got to just clarify it a little.
Yes.
And specify this makeup or not.
Right.
I think you're silent on the makeup.
Okay.
Hey, what did you have in there?
Yeah. Elsewhere in here it says that all of the books are included in the tuition and fees.
Yes.
So, what if they don't give them back to you?
No, they keep them. We give them. They come to class, they get their book, and they take it.
So I've been here for 3 days, and I've gotten a stack of books, and I leave.
So
I'm going to leave with all of those books, and you're not going to charge me anything extra.
So the enrollment in the class starts when they have an online course where they start the class. So enrollment starts at that point. So 3 days into it would be beginning their online program. Then they would come to class, they're past their 3 days. At that point, they do have some recourse. There would be some recourse.
Okay, there are going to be instances where you're going to lose money on this.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So what some schools have is that the books are included, and if they withdraw, they are expected to return unopened, unused books, something. If you don't have that, that's fine. But you are silent in it, so that means that if you give the student a stack of books and literally take it and leave, you cannot complain about it.
I actually like what you're saying. This is good. Yes, thank you.
Can I have it until 11?
So do I. I'd like to go first.
Okay. On page 11. On probation, you don't give the length of the probation, so you're saying a student will be put on probation, on academic probation, if they fail 2 or more tests. They can also be put on general probation for misconduct or failure. And you're saying it's reviewed on a case-by-case basis, but every 7 days. So does that mean the probation is 7 days, and is it then, are they then given another 7 days? Or are they, if they don't meet it within 7 days, are they out? Just be clear about what the, and it doesn't matter what the rule is, you just have to say what it is. Can they have more than one? Some schools have, if you've been on a one probation, you're not granted another. Or you're only granted one academic and one general, whatever. So whatever you say, just make it clear so that students know. Mm-hmm. Some are going to push it, and they're going to do everything and say, well, I got off that probation. So now we've cleared on another one. You can't say anything because you didn't say it was limited to one. But if you say it's limited to one and then you let them have a second, you can't. So figure out what you want.
All right. We'll update that policy.
And then I'll jump above because actually before that, another warning. I find this attendance one confusing, and maybe it's just me, but this says when a student exceeds 50% of his or her allowance of absences or tardies for a course that is still in session, they'll be sent an attendance warning to remind them that they're left. So I'm trying to figure out what that 50% is.
That's a little confusing. Yeah.
Is it 1.5 days since 3 days they'll be dropped? Is it 10% since 20% they may be dropped? Is it,
that is a little confusing.
Is it 2.5 days for tardies since 5 days? It's nothing.
I guess, I mean,
what is the 50% of his or her allowed absences or tardies?
We've spoken to students already. We've had enough students where people they haven't been absent, but they've been tardy significantly.
Yeah.
And we pull them aside and we talk to them, and it's a verbal warning. We're still a small program, so it's very personalized. And we talk to them. We say, look, you need to be on time for class.
I have no problem with you doing that. That's fine, and what I would expect. But when, and I'm sensitive because I do chair the complaint committee with my, believe me, we'll see students who will complain about this because you have to quantify what that is.
Okay.
You quantify it by 50%, but what is it?
It's easier to say on your second absence or your third tardy.
Yeah, on your third tardy or your second absence, you will be,
And make sure you specify that it's a verbal or a written, and that you stick to that policy.
Remember, a catalog is your contract with the student.
Yeah, yeah.
You list what you're going to do for them and they have to do, and then you have to abide by it, okay? Because that's what we hold you accountable to. You say
it's going to be a written warning coming from the president of your school. It better be a written warning coming from the president of your school and not the president's secretary's, dog and somebody that,
it just needs to be clear. And Ms. Eckenberg, I liked her suggestion, and that's much clearer.
Okay.
And for the warning for attendance, it sounds like they put on warning until the end of the course. So that makes it sound like a warning will not cross over one course to the next. But if they don't meet it at the end of that course, what happens? You don't have to tell me, but you do have to tell them the catalog.
So
what happens at the end of it? Does that mean then that they're given one more chance for the next course? Whatever it is, so you put in on warning, but it has like no teeth. You put in on warning, they need to resolve by the end, but if they don't, no problem. And for the academic, you say they have to take another exam, but when? By the end of that course? By the end of the completion of the next course, within 30 days, within 5 days, whatever.
The day they return from their absence.
Right.
Yeah, that's what those are. And then same thing on leave of absence. You talk about leave of absence is strongly discouraged. That's fine. Due to the short nature of the course, a student who wishes to leave of absence for more than 3 days will be required to be withdrawn. So that makes it sound like your leave is limited to 3 days, but I'm not entirely sure. But then students who are unable to continue class for medical reasons or severe personal problems will be required to take a leave of absence and re-enroll. Well, if they're taking a leave of absence, why are they re-enrolling? Because they're still enrolled. So I'm just...
I think it's the terminology.
Do you know you don't have to have a leave of absence, especially for a short program like this?
You don't have to.
You don't have to have one.
But I know. But if we don't let someone back and then they end up complaining, we end up right here. So we want to try to resolve
everything.
I'm not
saying you don't let them back. You can have a withdrawal and a re-entry policy, which is totally different.
As written, this will cause you more problems than not having
it. It should be a re-entry policy. Because if they're missing...
A lot of people do confuse that. They think... And it might be that you're saying leave of absence as in, they don't have to be readmitted like you will let them back. And that's fine. So you can have an academic leave of absence that means one thing, but you have to word it in such a way that they understand what's going on.
Okay.
I had one thing on this. I don't know what that means by this.
Yeah, go down. I don't.
This program information sheet, is this something that is handed out, or did you do this for us?
I did for you.
Yeah.
Good answer.
My only worry is that we have a lot of schools that use puffery in their descriptions. And so you have clinical research, fast tracks, unique intensive short courses to their students, blah, blah, blah. And make sure that you can, if you're putting this anywhere else on your website and on any of your marketing materials, make sure you can truly back up the fact that it's unique. We've had schools come in and say the only one in the country, the only one in the world, and they were not. Unique is a little harder to bump up, but it does sort of sound like, you know, like we are all uniquely us. Just make sure you can defend it if you use it somewhere. Okay. So we'll come to the site committee, and you'll see three of us, and you won't be happy.
I think we're unique, though, at this point.
Well, actually,
you are. People are
going to. You are.
People are going to start copying.
I said it
model.
Myself.
Yeah, you did say it.
Yeah, you won't be the only one.
I know.
For long.
Okay.
So again, I just gotta watch. Doctor Nissen has
something. Page 2, you have a typo. Which I'm particularly pleased with myself. In the catalog to begin with.
Page 2 what?
The typo, the word complemented.
Which document?
Catalog.
Oh, in your catalog.
Oh, dear.
Hold on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dear. Oh, do you like it?
I did. I'm not the world's best spell. So
where's
the bottom program course outline.
Oh.
Complimented. But complimented as it's written would be like, that was a wonderful. That was fantastic. It must be the most unique school.
I have no idea.
It's spelled right for the wrong meaning.
And then I guess the other question I have is that it does sound interesting and unique. So my question is, and I know that you and your brother are the owners, and you've already invested $100,000 into it. And so for the $234,000 of gross tuition revenue minus the scholarships, $60,000, and then the amount of advertising and admissions is another $70,000. So it's about $150,000 of an effort to generate the $234,000 of tuition. And so how do you, what's the plan to make that more efficient?
So great question. We our first students who came to us, they came and they said, we didn't believe you were real. So we are overcoming this hurdle, and we are overcoming it, every student we enroll, which is, is this too good to be true? Are you really what you say you are? Are you a real school? They don't ask us that, but I think as we become more of a legitimate, established brand, so to speak, we will be enrolling a lot of those skeptics who saw us but never enrolled. So I think our marketing costs, which now are running 30% of revenue, which is really high, I think those dollars will be bringing in more and more students over time. So that 30% might go to 20%, 15%. And all of a sudden, it will be easier to enroll students. So we'll have a few more students for the same dollar, and all of a sudden, we can turn what right now is an investment into, we'll get an ROI return on this.
Any other questions? Right, we're ready for motion.
Indeed we are. I make the motion that we approve the conditional to regular vocational program license renewal for the clinical fast track with the following stipulations: that the school maintains a $15,000 surety bond, that you make the noted changes that were called out to your catalog, and you submit that catalog to the staff for review. Okay.
If motion, do you have a second?
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Please vote. Motion approved.
Thank you.
Oh, do you agree to the bond?
Yes. We agree to the bond. And is there a time frame in a month to get those changes to you, or 2 weeks, or
tomorrow?
No, actually, I don't know if any. None of those changes are ones that I think that we would prevent you from getting your license. Just behooves you to do them, and we'll be really cranky if you come back next time and they're not there.
Well, you don't have to, unless there's an issue.
Yeah.
Just email me the new catalog.
Okay.
Sometimes people keep his license for it, so the catalog is so bad.
This one's not contingent.
Getting close. The regular degree granting license application for University of Dubuque. Please, Dr. Mittman, please come forward.
You still with us?
We can just approve this. My mom's from Dubuque, so we can.
Yeah, I'm really from
Dubuque, Iowa. Yeah.
Are you like? I'm not a conflict.
Yeah, right.
Maybe I should recuse myself.
I honestly did not know.
As vice chair, I've been in Dubuque a few times.
Trish, would you please identify yourself for our record, please?
Amy Gaffney, the director of life at the University of Dubuque. Good to see you.
Todd Rogers, senior director of University Life Admissions.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, University of Dubuque is seeking a regular degree granting license to offer a selected number of bachelor and master programs to working adults in an accelerated face-to-face format in Tempe. This is what the University of Dubuque calls refers to as the LIFE program. They are accredited by HLC, reaffirmed in 2015 with no sanctions. And again, your board member leads are Mr. Mittman on finance and accrediting, and Trish, of course, on ENCAT.
Okay, well, thank you. Would you like to start us off with a statement and maybe explain what it's like to be the director of life?
We get to welcome people to life.
That's pretty wild.
And we get to see them to the end of life. So, we have a million of them. But, in my role as a director of life for the last, I'd say, 14 months, prior to that, I was an academic advisor for our Dubuque Life program, both undergrad and graduate programs. And through that, then through that evolution, over the last few years, it's become evident where we had some, growth. And we saw success in another market, which was the Cedar Rapids market, is about an hour and 20 minutes away from Dubuque. Also, again, that Cedar Rapids is about 20 minutes away from one of the state schools, the University of Iowa. So people were like, are you crazy going into another area, especially if there's another competitive program, several other private schools in the area? What are you thinking? But we've been very well received and encouraged, so much so that our cabinet and then our board found support into look elsewhere and how do we continue and can we, replicate this model in another area. The common question we're getting is why Tempe, why Phoenix? A combination of reasons. We do have some friends of the university in the Phoenix area who have been very helpful in giving us direction when we were talking about expanding our life program at all. And it wasn't the first place we looked, actually. We did consider some other markets, and it just seemed the more and more we looked at the Lumina Foundation research, talking about, again, just the size of Phoenix, then, of course, the size, the number of adult learners who have not yet completed their degree in the area. It seemed to be, lend itself at good odds. And as far as what we do, we are a face-to-face program. We are not an online program. With exception of one of our, there are into BSN, the major courses in that program will be an online. But everything else we do is very high touch, face to face. So I jokingly said, but not jokingly, we know that the University of Phoenix and Arizona State are, you know, mammoth in the area. We're not looking to put them out of business. But we do believe that they're just like we found in Dubuque and Cedar Rapids, that what we do and how we do it, there's a population to be served. And we feel very strongly about that, that we'll take for the people who don't want that online program or that semester-based program or that scale of that program. We can do that. We can serve them very well.
Did we skip the step where the staff vote that you introduced? There's nothing else to introduce. I'm just going to point. Are there any questions from other board members? No. I have just one question. I'm not sure that you'd be able to answer because it's around the composite score.
Okay.
The composite score was, you know?
3.0,
which is like, that's good. The max, right? And yet the university lost $2 million last year, so I'm just wondering.
Yeah, and let me qualify that. The composite score, I went with what was published by the U.S. Department of Education. So that's actually 14-15. Although I know, according, you know, in talking to our VP of Finance, who could not be here today, coincidentally, our board is in conference today, so otherwise they wouldn't even be on the phone. However, when he and I spoke about that, he did report, again, yes, it's 3.0. So even at his latest information, there was last year, I think is the number you may be referring to, there was a negative, but... I understand that's caused by we launched a significant program in this last year, so there was a significant outgoing for support to our new physician's assistant program on our residence campus.
Well, I mean, if the Department of Education accepted it as a 3.0, I'm not here.
Yeah.
I would just love to learn how to.
Well, and let me also say, yes. I am not the CFO, so you are correct that whatever other detailed questions you might have, I may have to call reinforcements.
I think, you know, just from, you know, from my review, and I think if you did review all of this, was, you know, obviously the university has been accredited since, I think, the 1930s, and has a very good reputation. Been in continuous accreditation. The financial statements are, you know, in spite of whatever loss there was some revenue generated from the endowment, which is, I think, about $85 million. So in terms of the application looks all in order. As far as from a financial standpoint. Other questions or comments about the...
I have a few. Usually we put colored tabs so they can just glance and see how many questions, but I didn't feel like getting up, and so I only turned my pages down.
There's not that many.
In tab 14, you just say the University of Dubuque operates under an academic year definition of standard term. But I'm curious, is it semester or quarter?
I'm sorry, semester, yeah.
And do you have modules within the semester?
Yes, our life program has modules within the semester, not the traditional campus, so I'm speaking to life. We operate in a 5-week course modules.
Okay. And I'm only asking this because sometimes when schools come before us that have been in existence for 100 years, sometimes they don't keep up on all of the rules, so... just in passing, make sure you know the rules about modules related to financial aid.
I just came, before I joined life, I was 20 years in financial aid. So
you're good. Okay.
I'm listening to you. I'm like, yep. So yes.
Actually, I watched you nodding because I was waiting to hear what your background was.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I saw that too.
Yeah. on page 23, the grievance procedures, you don't yet have Arizona on there. Is it somewhere else in the catalog?
No, actually, Absolutely. I'm wondering if that's a typo or a print, because they're absolutely, I have the section on there, not in there?
I know. I mean, oh, yeah, we'd have that.
Yeah.
It had to be somewhere back.
Okay.
But I'm on page 23, and it says grievance procedures, and it just talks about, it doesn't include Arizona, so sure must be somewhere.
I think it's like the last section after the form.
I don't have 23.
I'm
2.
See?
Well, if we have it somewhere else, it should. I think it should be there too, because you just want it.
Well, and with that, I will say.
This, I'm sorry, this is in the handbook, not the catalog.
Okay, it's for sure.
Okay, so it's in the handbook. Then that may be true. In writing that, I developed like two forms. I mean, the format for this is a student, and then I refer them to the website, which is our under development, by the way, and I don't have the exact URL of where it's going to be. But once that is finalized, I'm referring the website from the handbook, and then on the website is the complete full-out, including the form, and I know it's in that process, so I do wonder if I abbreviated.
It happens a lot when they're when things are multiple places.
Correct.
So
page 20.
In the handbook on page 23.
I'm in the catalog.
I was actually in the because the tab handbook. Says catalog and checklist, but it's actually the handbook is the first thing.
I will clarify that. I'll make sure I have it.
So the first section between the green pages happens to be the handbook. Now in the catalog. I only have a little bit. So you have a, right after the student handbook has University of Dubuque, and it doesn't say it's a catalog, it just, on the first page, but on the next page, it says graduate catalog.
So yes, so there's a graduate catalog, and then there's the undergraduate traditional catalog.
So this catalog is much smaller, but there's no table of contents, and it's nice to have a table of contents even if it's not that big of a book.
Through this process and over the course of my last year, I've actually convinced my vice president for economic affairs that I'm creating a catalog dedicated just to life. So what you have here is how we've been operating this present year, the 2016-17 year, and so it is referencing the existing graduate catalog, which is outside of my purview, referencing the traditional undergraduate and wherever else I could. But I have been advocating, we are now working on having a dedicated life catalog to consolidate the information and make it a simpler reference for the student.
Oh, that would be nice.
Yeah.
Page 5, assessment of progress, it's just two sentences, and that is shy. On page 13, it mentions financial aid, satisfactory progress, and it does mention warning and suspension, but again, it's a very short policy, and the feds have a lot more things they want you to spell out. This is a personal preference in your institution refund policy.
Yes.
Making a reference saying students who receive Title IV are also subject to the return to Title IV policy. Students get confused that they're being charged the tuition based on the institution refund policy, that their aid might be going back. So if you link them in between, they'll be less confused as they can be with such a confusing policy. And then very little left, we're almost there. And the undergrad catalog, which is better. I like your undergrad catalog better. On page 191, it kind of sounds like you're allowing an ability to benefit students.
I'd have to, revisit that.
So if you would revisit that, and not that you are not allowed to, but if they are ability to benefit, unless they're grandfathered in, then they don't get to the floor, so you need to specify that. And we've certainly seen that. The students are eligible to enroll, but then they get upset when they find out they're not eligible to get Title IV, so you would need to spell that out. And you don't have any age listed, and I know some schools like to not have an age limit because if they have a doobie houser, they want to take them in. but it would behoove you to make some mention, even if it's like generally this age, but this is what you go through for an exception type of thing. On page 196, another reference assessed progress. So I've now found it at three places, which I find confusing, although this one's better. But you're specifying it as five academic years, and then you talk about 150%. That's not the same time period, so look at that. Mm-hmm. And make that good. On page 197, right kind of in the middle, it says, if at the end of the warning period, the appropriate minimum cumulative GPA average is not achieved, all financial aid will be subject to termination. So that means you're not allowing them to have a probation and they...
Yeah, we do allow. Yeah.
So then you guys say, unless you appeal, see whatever.
And I also think there's a reference in there that, from hearing from you, again, from the outside looking at it, a clarification of institutional. So the five-year reference is to institutional aid, and that's the same thing. So I that's the part that I think they need to clarify.
You can have whatever policies you want, you just can't be confusing.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
And you have to meet everybody's requirements.
Thank you.
And that's all I have. Which is to say something for both this thick.
I know, I'm sorry.
Really, really.
The fact that that's all I have, you get some sort of rounding points or something.
Great. Well, I will say, Terry Stanfield's wonderful. Oh, yeah. I said that to you on phone, but from the heart, this is the first time I've gone through this process, and it was a welcome experience because of the support and responsiveness from her. So that's thank you.
You're just trying to rack them up. That's too much.
Yeah.
I don't get this very often.
Oh, my.
I don't.
Usually, the harder that she is on them, then the smoother it goes through. And some people, instead of appreciating the fact that she was hard on them, so it goes smoothly here, they get comfy about it.
Yeah.
So where are you at as far as your timetable? Because here we are.
Today was really an important day. Yeah. We've been just laying in wait. My academic representative, I'm on the cusp of hiring someone, and that'll be, you know, a significant mover. But, we've just been waiting for the go sign. Of course, once we have clearance here, then we'll work on with the Title IV notification to the Department of Education and HLC, of course, the official process. But we're very eager to get going. Just can't wait to get started.
Are you in the notification process for HLC, or
yes.
Do you have to apply? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. Coincidentally, the graduate program has another opportunity, so we're putting those notifications in the substantive change right now. I mean, she's waiting for me to call her.
Flip the switch, right?
Literally, yes, yes. So.
Oh,
so,
yeah. It's a five.
Yes. What's that?
It's a five.
Are you with them also?
Yes.
You're sitting there smiling and nodding, so I thought perhaps you were a good... They didn't
he's our local rep. Well, no, he's... Terry knows Mike.
Yeah, Mike.
Terry knows
he's
Mike.
Our local director
and
of admission, one of the
Mike's
two.
Back.
We have a staffing model of four, and he's one of our two admission reps. We have an operations coordinator, and then my fourth academic person will be filling the fourth spot. So Mike has been a tremendous help through this process. And when Ms. Stanfield said on the phone, well, if you were here, I'd give you your original book back. I said, I got somebody. So, because we evaluate that feedback. So
you don't get these back for a while, though, but I'll call you and you can come visit.
Great. So, and what is the next stage for us then? What do we, as far as the determination and then sort of official notification after that, how does that work? No, I know that.
We have to get approved first.
That's what I'm asking. Yes, so. Yeah, just the overall process.
I'll tell you one thing.
Sure.
I make a motion to approve the Red George degree granting license application for the University of Duke.
One second.
Hearing first and second, are there any additional discussion?
Stipulation.
No stipulations, but I'm not asking for bond or blood or anything. No, they have a liability insurance. Congratulations.
Not with a 3.0 composite score.
Keep it that way.
Yeah.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? That's that. Congratulations. Welcome to the
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
You can call her to flip the switch. You're good to go as of right now.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'll get it out next
week. Thank you. And you were my first phone call, so thank you for
that's all I had to do with the phone call.
I can say this is very educational.
Oh, yeah.
Come on up.
I didn't have an invitation ring.
You don't look too happy.
The last case today, conditional location of program license application for Dev Mountain. Ms. Sandfeld.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Dev Mountain is seeking a non-accreditational program license to offer a program in web development immersive boot camp. They are also licensed in Utah and Texas. They are owned by Capella Education Company, which is a publicly traded company, but this is, I think some of the other universities are starting to do these boot camp things. So it's a new thing. Your board member chair is Mr. Chick.
Yes.
Yeah, at the DEA State Conference, they were talking about this being like the new up and coming thing that
just like Microsoft was millions, not millions a year, but yeah, that's
well, that's why when I emailed you, this looks
this too
super
familiar.
Familiar. It was the other boot camp we just did last time.
It's like,
time.
Hey, you're my go-to guy.
It's like Salt Lake City, same locations. So
is Kristen on the phone? Do you know?
I believe she's still.
Yep, I'm here.
Are you still there, on, Kristen? Whoa. Okay.
I've been here all day.
Having fun?
Yeah.
Okay. So Steven's been here all day too.
Yeah.
Can you both introduce yourselves?
Kristen, would you please go first?
Sure. My name is Kristen Hansen. I'm a regulatory consultant with Capella, and I've worked with Terry before on behalf of Capella University and echo all the compliments that she's received today. She's a great person to work with.
Thank you.
I'll have a party
tonight.
Madam Chair, board, and staff, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Stephen Garamantes. You guys can just call me V. Keep it that simple. I'm the general manager and director for Dev Mountain here in Arizona. And we're excited to expand into this market and to grow the tech talent that's much needed in this state.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about Dev Mountain, the concept of programs
yep.
you're going to be offering?
Yes, sir. Dev Mountain is a technology education company that focuses on technology, web development, iOS development, UI, UX, anything that has to do with any of the mobile apps or web apps that you guys most enjoy. We help students create those for you and for other companies. And we do this through an immersive program that is 13 weeks, 12 weeks of instruction. And our students then graduate and then are placed with technology companies or startups or any type of corporate entities that are in need of our students. We have graduated nearly 1,000 students in our short period of time in our three various locations, the majority being in Wichita, Utah. And we've been a direct impact for growing Utah's technology and innovation sectors with our students and our graduates. Our student graduates are represented in every, are in the majority of the Fortune 50 companies that you're all aware of, Google, Apple, Microsoft, et cetera. We pride ourselves in instructing our students, giving them hands-on learning and education in the most desired and most up-to-dated craft in technology development, which we refer to as stacks. And technology literally changes, seems like quarterly, and we make sure that our curriculum and our students are keeping up with that speed, and we're iterate our curriculum on the fly as technology changes. But we focus specifically in right now for Phoenix on our web development.
Okay. So the income statement you have here, that's for the three locations you currently have?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So for last year, when did you start up officially? What was your startup date?
Our startup date was in 2014.
14, okay.
Yes, sir.
So you're up for running two years. This is for 2016. And the three locations at $800,000 loss in the income statement?
Just for the 2016, because after our acquisition from Capella University, we shifted into sixth gear and put our money down into expansion, which is Phoenix and other markets. So we're currently operating at a loss, but obviously have the backing of a publicly traded company with revenues over $200 million to help us with that expansion.
So the are you saying the facilities expense has Phoenix in there as far as those?
No, none. Okay. There's no, the only operating costs that are associated in the balance sheet are reflective on administrative fees and payroll.
Okay.
There are no operating expenses currently because we're not legally able to operate as of this moment.
So what is your break even then for a particular campus?
12 students.
12 students a month you have to enroll?
12 students per cohort, which roll every 12 to 13 weeks.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. And are you hitting that? I mean, I'm just wondering why you
have... We're crushing that.
Okay, I'm just... What am I not seeing here as far as why they have an $800,000 loss? Yeah.
It's because we have made capital investments just this past year. We built a new location in Dallas, and that was quite a bit of capital expenditures. We onboarded myself, and I'm not cheap. Those are some additional expenditures that we haven't been able to offset with revenue from generating Phoenix campus. We ran into some regulatory issues in Texas that have been resolved, and we're legally operating there.
Okay.
And so we were on hold for a while, so we were operating in the loss for a very short period of time.
All right, I appreciate that explanation.
Can I just throw in, Salt Lake City was also 2016, so it's both Dallas and Salt Lake City.
Very good. So you have been here May 1st for start date. When are you actually trying to plan to start?
At 5 p.m. The funnel's already loaded, man. We literally push grow, and it drops all the digital market into a funnel, and it's done.
Okay. On that. That's going to be incredible. Talk to me about the attendance policy. Attendance, every day you must attend.
Yeah, every screw. And the reason why I say it, and I put it, you know, I was a student in the program myself, right? After finishing at Harvard and MIT, I went straight over to Death Mountain to learn how to code myself. And I can tell you it's the hardest thing that I've ever done personally. You know, even harder than both Harvard and MIT in those programs. And the reason why is because of what it requires to do in a very short period of time. So we encourage our students to stay the entire duration, and while our classes go from, you know, 8 to 9 hours a day, I can firsthand attest to you that most of the students stay probably 12 hours, and the way that we have structured our curriculum with our immersive boot camp by providing housing for our students that is included in the price of tuition. These students literally are coding, you know, all day, day, and all night. We really emphasize that. So while they may miss class, it's only to their own detriment because each lesson builds on top of the other. It's difficult to catch up unless they put in the time. The simple way to say is you can't hack hacking. There's just no way around it. No shortcuts.
So the person gets a flu, and it takes 3 days to recover. They could be in the 12th week, and they're out of luck. They're kicked out.
No, absolutely not. Like,
because it says two absences and you're out.
Okay. Part of the program is that if they do miss time, they're able to make up that time. Each of the students is assigned a specific mentor that's responsible for their success, along with the student success person that monitors that student success as well. All our classes are all recorded live, so they have access to review those and have those and have access to those in real time because they're streamed.
Do you know offhand where it says makeup? Because honestly, I didn't see that, but
I did see it.
I didn't have the paper when I was doing it on the computer, yeah. So I could have missed it.
The other thing we do as well is our students are able to repeat our program at no additional cost as many times as they need to until they feel comfortable to relearn the program. So
I had on page 8, I put no makeup? And then two absences.
What tab are you referring to?
Probably the catalog.
Tab 12.
Is that on page 8?
Yeah, I put on page. I don't have a full paper copy of it, so I went online, but my note said no makeup, page 8, 2
actions. It does say no makeup work is permitted unless previously authorized.
Unless previously authorized. Mm-hmm.
Well, what's previous? So I wake up throwing up and I can't come for 3 days. I couldn't ask you ahead of time, was it okay if I didn't come that day because I didn't know I was going to be throwing up. So what does previously authorized mean?
Yeah. I guess where I was getting with this is because the grading policy says pass-fail. So is it really they've got to finish, like you said, they work and they keep completing work and they keep going until they finish the work in the program. Mm-hmm. And they're not really graded on that, but they're accepting pass-fail.
You have been conducting a meeting for a long period of time. If you need to continue meeting, press 1 now. If not, I'll end the meeting.
We've been doing it for a long period.
All right, so where I was going with that was, it sounds like it's kind of self-paced.
It is. It's
so
very.
That's why I was wondering, you know, the strict nature on the attendance.
Yeah, it's very much self-paced. Like when we go through our learning modules and going through our lessons, like each one does build off the other. For some individuals, the day goes by really slow, and because it takes them much more time to be able to learn new concepts. For others, days go by fairly quickly, and they're able to catch the concepts fairly quickly. While we do focus on moving the students through as quickly as possible, the way that our curriculum is structured and our programming is that they have lessons in the mid-morning. They do paired programming, meaning they're paired with another student in the afternoon. One is verbally explaining syntax, meaning what the logic is to type, and the other person is actually typing. And that we trade off, and then the rest of the afternoon is doing the individual personal project in regard to the curriculum that we just have learned that day. They do get that exposure, and what we do is we kind of ask, like, hey, on a 1 to 10 scale, like, how do you feel about these concepts? And for those that score, obviously it's self-declared, but those that score, you know, less than 5, the mentors are specifically assigned to those individuals to be able to help them get them up to a speed where they feel comfortable to move on to the next step.
Okay, thank you. So the admission requirements, 18 years of age, no minimum education level required. So you have somebody come in, they're 18 years of age, they do well in your program. Is it realistic that they're going to get a job without a high school GED or a high school or GED?
Absolutely.
At a company, really?
Yeah. And like the thing is with coding, there's like no ceiling to potential, and coding literally is it's not really partial to your background, socioeconomics, your accreditations from universities. Like, it's very binary, either you do or you don't. And so you either ship good code and build great products, but it doesn't really matter your background. One case I can tell you specifically is an 18-year-old student just barely had graduated high school. He was in my cohort learning iOS, building iPhone apps. His father told him to go to college. He said, no, I want to learn how to do this dev thing, right? His dad was in education, you know, probably maxed out, you know, probably $70,000 with a pension, et cetera. Cole, he finished our program in 3 months, and he was offered an $85,000 job 3 weeks later. As an 18-year-old who just barely finished high school.
But he finished high school.
He finished high school.
That's my only concern, is that our I don't think you should get in the... I'm not asking to say you should counsel these people who come in without a high school degree to say, this might be difficult for you to find a job with a company if you don't have a high school diploma.
Sure.
But I'm assuming a lot of this is contract work, too.
Some of it is contract work, but rest assured that 71% of all our graduates out of our program actually have college degrees. Okay. So the majority actually have 4-year degrees.
Very good.
Their graduate
all right.
program. That would be a very, very rare exception for someone to come without a GED.
A suggestion might be you might want to put in there that generally students must have high school diploma or the equivalent, and exceptions may be made. You know, so that people coming in are expecting that's what they have, and if they're
Yeah.
If they dropped out of school in seventh grade, they may be a coding genius, they may be get a job, but they pay all that money to go to your boot camp, and then they're a brilliant coder, but the companies all have a requirement. You have to have a minimum of a high school diploma. You're not doing that.
That's totally understandable. And if that norm would be broken, it would definitely happen in this industry, in this field.
But it would be good for you to say that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, we'll definitely, part of our responsibility for our student success personnel is to be able to help these individuals with those type of circumstances to help get them to that point.
Then I have one other question. On the refund policy, are there any separate books and supplies that they have to?
We literally give them, they just have to bring their own computer with them. We give them, you know, a part of our tuition includes housing. So you pay the $11,000, and you come learn how to code for 3 months. We'll give you even a place to stay, and we'll give you a Metro card. You'll be able to use their light rail and the bus system here free of charge. Well, not free of charge, but included in your tuition. We remove all barriers of entry for anyone that wants to learn how to code and change their life through technology education.
But there aren't any supplies that they would have to give back to you if they...
No, ma'am. Okay. Everything on site is fixed property, meaning with their extra monitors or keyboards or whatever.
Okay. What's my other question?
I appreciate that you included your coding challenges, what they were, because the last one, last school that we had come in here didn't, it was really confusing what that meant, so thank you.
Yeah.
The only other thing I have is in your advertisement, you do say the most affordable five-star code school in the country. That's a...
Puffery.
Could be puffery. I mean...
Unless you can prove it.
So we actually, our legal department is currently reviewing all marketing pieces for that exact issue and evaluating where we can support those claims and where we might need to adjust. So those are some just samples from kind of the original Utah and Dallas marketing campaign. So we're currently in the process of reviewing all that.
Okay, so just so you know, for us, if you say you're five-star, you better be able to prove who it is who is award, and it can't be you.
Absolutely. absolutely well-versed in that type of claim support, so we're definitely looking at everything from top to bottom.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just ask for clarification? It's $10,800, 3 months, and it includes housing.
And a Metro card.
And a Metro card. Food too.
We do have a fully stocked kind of.
And is there a
break room ish?
Minimum is 18. Is there like a?
Can we go?
For
middle aged people.
Yeah. To be very honest with you, we've had individuals that were, you know, were one guy was a director of Goldman Sachs that came through our program and learned how to code. That's what we wanted to do. And then we had, you know, folks that are literally waitresses or baristas come through our program and be very successful in our program. Like,
what if they live here? So we live in the valley and decide to go, so we don't need the house.
Get the Metro card.
It doesn't matter. Like, we provide that to you, but just for simplicity purposes, we just kept that for everybody. But you do decide that you want to exercise that option, that's totally up to you.
But you're not going to give me any money back?
No money back.
No, that's how our program is built. It's built in.
Just in case we get a complaint, we should be ready.
Yeah, sure. And we make that pretty clear, like, up front with folks. And that's one of the most common questions asked is, hey, if we don't use your housing, is there a discount? And the answer is no.
Okay. Well, very, very nice report. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? I'll make a motion to approve the conditional vocational program license application for Dev Mountain with the stipulation that the surety bond be increased to $101,000.
Is that still required with our commercial insurance?
Yeah, that doesn't have anything to do with your... that's just for your protection. The bond is for...
Yeah.
Our protection and students.
Kristen, did you get that?
Yep, $101,000.
Okay.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Actually, before I do, no. So do you accept the condition of the bond?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, we do.
All right. Any nays? All right, motion passed. Thank you for your patience.
Flip that switch.
Thank you. No, we will in 90 minutes.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, waiting Kristen. For him.
Thank you.
I'm waiting for the app. All right, call to the public.
I think we outlasted the whole entire public.
Executive Director's report.
I will only add, I don't have anything, unless you guys have any questions. The governor did sign Senate Bill 1293 yesterday, which is the one to exempt. Yeah, I checked this morning, he signed it. That will exempt programs under 40 hours and $1,000.
That's probably a good deal.
So the caregivers and we'll probably lose 5-6. And you probably have wondered who J.R. Pima is on your emails that I've been sending you. As of actually Monday, and I didn't know it, Dick Lukey Jr. with Pima Medical from Tucson was confirmed. I knew he'd been appointed, I just didn't know he'd been appointed. He was not able to come to this meeting, previously scheduled trip.
Okay. So
we will be a full board as of May. Cell phone.
Oh, they can't wait for that.
I don't think I have any other Wilkes winning, you know, we have a lot of schools that teach out. We're going to lose. Yeah. It'll be interesting in June to see what our final count is. That's when our fiscal year end is, in June. Were we going to update? Oh, yeah. We're still fighting with the bankruptcy court for IPT, but I think we've come to the conclusion we're going to say just give us our boxes back, we'll pay for it without messing with the trustee and the bankruptcy court. It's just getting really stupid.
They gave us three options, none of which are very appealing. So, and the price tag is in the millions of dollars for the solutions that they want to split up between like 21 states. And I mean, it would literally cost us a few $1,000 to get back.
Just to get your files back of how many students?
The files that they took out of the state to start with.
The trustee.
That shouldn't have left the state.
And so we ticked the trustee off when we took our records.
Yeah, so it was a $3 million price tag to digitize them and back to us to split between all the states. A $1 million price tag just to get the boxes back to the state.
Yeah.
And then a $1 million price tag just to index what's in the boxes to figure out which boxes need to go to which states.
I think you guys should just contact Amazon and see if they'll do it for Prime.
So just give us our boxes.
We're working on it.
Kevin's working on it. Kevin's also been spearheading our e-licensing project, which they now have a vendor.
Oh, are you going to the 13?
We're one of the Berlins, first of the 13.
Yeah. Maybe just a brief update on that. So all of our system, you see when we do renewals, is all massive amount of paperwork.
Antiquated.
So the state's contracted with Deloitte to use a software program called Salesforce, which I'm sure some of you use in your schools. So we'll be utilizing that, I hope, by December, which means it would automate everything that we do. So all the schools would be doing their own submission through the website. So they wouldn't be sending us tons of paperwork that we currently get.
Do they each have to have their own Salesforce license to sign up?
I mean, that is part of what our licensing is through the state, so everybody will have a fee. So any user internally would have one, and all of our external 220-some-odd schools, we would pay for that out of our budget, a small amount for each one to have access to.
All right.
And I won't hold my breath because I've only been working for trying to get this proposal for 8 years.
Salesforce can be really, it's very flexible.
Very flexible. I think it's going to do a great job for us.
Yay. All right. I will accept a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Any discussion?
3:30.